Welcome to Radio Free Nintendo, episode 278. I'm your host, Jonathan Metz, and with me, as always, is John Lindemann.
My pleasure, Johnny, as usual.
Greg Leahy.
Come on, Eli. I mean, hello.
James Jones.
Yep.
Folks, we got a really big show for you coming up today, including our big retroactive discussion of Fire Emblem and the Sacred Stones for Game Boy Advance. In the second segment, but first up, we've got new business, and Greg has a pretty big blockbuster game to talk about this week.
Yep, Revelations did indeed come the day after we recorded last week, so I pretty much had a whole week with it, and the Pro, the Circle Pad Pro, came with it.
Revel what?
Well, I can't pronounce misspelling, so you're just going to have to deal with it. But, yeah, it's kind of appropriate, the Circle Pad Pro being bundled with this game, given though it was described as this sort of horrible mutation thing with another sort of eye hanging off the side of it and all that. It's pretty appropriate, but the long and the short of it is I'm glad I had the opportunity to get it pretty much for free due to the way it was bundled, because the way the game experience has gone, I've only dabbled with the dual stick controls, but I do think it is beneficial to have the Circle Pad Pro. And it's pretty comfortable. I've got big hands.
Ladies.
Strong hands, strong mind, James. But
ladies.
It's a lot more comfortable to grip for prolonged periods. And I mean, these chapters that, they are kind of broken into these little episodes, complete with a sort of cheesy previously on bit, which is kind of painful to sit through when you actually play more than one chapter at a time. But, even still, you might be playing it for half an hour at a time sometimes, because it's not something that I've been taking with me, playing portably. I've just been playing it at home. So you might expect the Pro is, I doubt, ever going to leave the confines of my house. But the biggest thing that I've seen with the Pro is that, I mean, first of all, I suppose you have to get a little used to the idea of face buttons being to the inside of a stick, right, rather than above or below. But the thing is, the way the Revelation scheme works is that almost all the action is happening on the shoulder buttons.
Right.
You've got, you're aiming with on the left, and then you're shooting on the right, and then you've got the sub-weapon on the other right shoulder button, because there's two now.
Oh, right. Oh, so that's actually cool.
Yeah, so I mean, the point is you're very rarely having to worry about reaching inside and using the face buttons. The only thing is A is used to activate a herb to replenish your health. So that's just inside of the sticks. Apart from that, and a few quick timey kind of things when some of the enemies get on top of you, really don't have to worry about the face buttons. So it works really well in that way. You could just the weirdness of it quickly gets kind of forgotten, and you're just playing it, much like you would play a lot of dual stick games. Obviously I have not played that many like third person shooters, but I have played Dead Space, so it felt really natural. And the interesting part of it, I think, relative to the game structure, is on the one hand you've got a lot of the game is set on the ship, and in that most of the action is happening in very enclosed spaces, dark corridors. You're not necessarily dealing with enemies coming at you from all sides or any of this kind of stuff. So I can imagine the standard control scheme in which you still have a number of different options, but you're not quite as free to move and shoot at the same time. You could sort of strafe and shoot, but you can't really aim at the same time as moving and shooting. So, it's not the full sort of liberalization that way, unless you're using, I think, the gyro controls, which is another option.
But God.
The point is, it doesn't seem like those bits would really be a problem. But then you've got these sort of outside chapters with other characters or at different points in the timeline. And those almost all involve some sort of siege type moment. You know, think of RE4 where you're in the house and you're getting mobbed by zombies from everywhere and all that. I mean, not literally quite like that, but it's the same sort of idea. It's basically like, well, you're holding a position for a certain amount of time for some reason. Tons of enemies coming in from everywhere, and I'm not as sure that the regular controls would hold up as well there as they would in the normal setting. So that's where I've been really sort of glad for the pro. And the other aspect of it as well is there's quite a lot of swimming as I've got deeper into the game. I think I'm pretty close to the end now. And again, that functions, you know, quite nicely with dual sticks, but I'm not so sure whether it'd be quite as good with just the one. So I've been very grateful to have that kind of control ease and no kind of funkiness or weirdness that detracted from the experience. I've just been able to roll through it very smoothly. And it isn't too difficult. Yes, the main part of the game doesn't just rain ammo from the skies or anything like that. You know, there's a certain amount of needing to conserve ammo. And certainly some enemies are much more easily dispatched with like a certain kind of gun. For instance, these things that jump out of the water that really you would want to have the shotgun for because it drives them back. Whereas if you just like start putting a few machine gun rounds in it, it's still going to jump on top of you and start killing you. So in other words, you're going to want to not use the shotgun on other stuff. But you know, in general, especially if you use the scanner, which is a new part of the game, I'm not sure if I'm that thrilled about it. You know, it seems a little bit underdeveloped in that you could scan enemies, but it's all just for accruing health items. Mm-hmm. And there's sort of a risk reward with that in terms of if you scan it while it's an enemy, while it's still alive, you build up more credit towards getting another green herb.
Yeah, they did it the same way in Bioshock.
Yes, that's right. It is much the same sort of mechanic as Bioshock there. But the interesting thing is that one of the complaints that I read about the game, which I think is quite valid upon playing it, is that you don't necessarily get that much feedback when you're pumping bullets into enemies about what part of them is the most vulnerable, apart from obviously headshots are always going to be a good one, but it's not always the sense that you are really hurting them. You know, there's just this little explosion of blood that comes out.
Yes.
It's not very physical. You take something like Dead Space where you're cutting off their arms and legs as you shoot them and all that. You know, I mean, you've got these enemies which in many ways have been very much dehumanized compared to the normal Resident Evil enemy. The only controversy you could possibly have about this game is that Resident Evil is racist against lobster people. You know, you couldn't have the whole RE5 thing. They're just not close enough to being human. So on the one hand, you think, well, that probably lets them get away with doing terrible things to these enemies because they're not vaguely like people anymore. But you really don't. I mean, you just pump them full of bullets until they melt, pretty much. And so it's kind of difficult to get a sense at first. You know, you really have to kind of trial and error it in terms of what is hurting them the most, what are the best areas to hit them. And the thing is, you'd think the scanner perhaps could tell you that.
Yeah, like the scanner in Killer 7, where it shows you the weak points.
Yeah, something that like that, just an additional reason to use the scanner. I mean, pretty much the only reason you'd be using the scanner is to get those green herbs, and also you could scan for sort of hidden items hidden around. It's definitely going to help you stay ahead of the ammo curve if you take the time to scan a lot of these rooms for those.
So what you're describing is what I least enjoyed about the demo, both at E3 and then again when I played it just recently, is that when I'm shooting, I just don't, they don't even seem to recoil that much when you shoot them. They just kind of lumber along and they might stop as if you bumped into somebody. I mean,
like I said, in certain cases there are, like I said, with the shotgun, you know, sometimes right. You could actually like force them to be driven back, or there are times when you could daze them, which leaves them open to, like, you could just do a sort of quick-timey thing where you punch them really hard, which is strangely effective. You've been pumping all sorts of ordnance into them, and then, oh, well, if I just kick it in the face with a little bit of a death twirl, then obviously that's going to finish it off. But, I mean, I agree, it's odd to me that on the one hand, they've kind of... it's been sanitized a little bit, basically. You know, the gore level is not as high as other Resident Evils, and the fact that they are much less recognisably human, the enemies across the board, you would think it would have given them the liberty to keep that sort of very physical kind of feel to it when you're killing things, dismembering them, but it isn't there, and that's an issue. Although I understand that the raid mode, which is sort of like the high score kind of challenge thing that you can play online and cooperatively, all that kind of stuff, I haven't really tried that, but apparently that gives you readouts for points when you're hitting different parts of it, of an enemy. So you could actually discern from that where the best place is to shoot enemies if you were sort of playing it alongside.
I have a question about, you know, you're saying that they've kind of sanitized a little bit. Do you feel that the game actually earns its mature rating or the equivalent in Europe?
Well, it's actually a 16 in Europe, not an 18. There's a sort of, there is a disparity there. So, I mean, it's not the maximum. And I'm sure if it were, you know, RE4.
Well, yeah, I mean, your character can be decapitated by a chainsaw. I mean, is there anything like that in Revelations, or does the game in general feel like it's just a little less brutal?
Yeah, you could get run through by a sort of nasty creature that's got like a saw-like mutated appendage, but it's not as brutal, no. Mm. It isn't. For those that care about that, you know, the visceral sort of impacts of these things, it's not the same.
Yeah, I actually really found, to me that's not such a bad deal, because I actually really found the chainsaw bit to be just over the top to the point that it just sort of felt like it didn't really need to be there. Like, that, I mean, that became...
Yeah, it didn't really add anything.
That was like their marketing pitch for the game. I mean, for God's sakes, they released a GameCube controller shaped like a chainsaw to glorify it. It just really felt...
gratuitous.
Yeah, it felt, and it, it almost felt detracting from the game. Like, I wasn't upset that I died. I was just upset that I had to watch that scene again.
I really like that stuff, because that stuff really links Resident Evil to the classic sort of B-movie grindhouse horror scene that it was originally trying to go for. And to me, that's really important to have in there. I mean, the way that you do it, the amount of gore is all up for debate, but the game needs to have a kind of a gritty, gross feel to it. I mean, you know, and Dead Space does a really good job of this. And I keep thinking about Dead Space in relation to this game, because for one thing, the enemies in Revelations do kind of look like low-grade necromorphs. And, you know, they're obviously Dead Space owes a ton to Resident Evil 4. But I don't know, it feels like Resident Evil has always been pretty disgusting. And I wonder if they're moving away from that.
Well, I know with RE6, they've said that they're trying to kind of branch out and make it a game for, you know, the modern warfare players. They're trying to bring those players in.
So, which could fit into this sort of general idea of being more action than horror. But of course, the weird thing with this is that at the same time, it's trying to kind of go back to more horror focused, you know, in terms of the parts on the ship. And I mean, with those sections, I think atmospherically, it's fairly effective. So as I said, the ship is a pretty good place to have as the kind of haunted houses in terms of, you know, all the things you can do with noises and the acoustics of it. And the music is generally pretty good. Not that memorable, but I think it's quite atmospheric. And you can have certain amount of locational variety in some of the parts of the ship are strikingly opulent, or you've got like a casino in there. So, you know, it's not just all hallways and the portholes and boring kind of stuff. So it's a good location, and I think the atmospherics are pretty strong with the sound design and all that kind of thing. So I think it's going more for that. I mean, the way the enemies move and all that is kind of creepy.
Right, they're kind of the shambling mess of flesh.
Yeah, although one interesting part in terms of this idea of the classic being alone in the dark in the haunted house is that you're not alone most of the time. You generally have a partner character in most of these bits, which, you know, you'll get separated from them and stuff, and you don't have to worry about them when you're in the middle of a fight with a bunch of enemies and stuff. I mean, they can take hits and it's not going to cause you a game over. You don't really have to save them or anything. And they're of limited usefulness in terms of how much they're going to kill the enemies. Although there is a particular kind of enemy, I guess, is pretty common in these sorts of games, which sort of inflates and blows up if you shoot it.
Yeah.
It was one occasion where my friend shot at it right when I was next to it, thereby blowing me up. But, you know, the main thing is really is that they're in there kind of narratively, you know, they're going to explain what's going on in the plot or say, okay, well, now we've got to go to this part of the ship to fix something or whatever. And so that's interesting because that kind of breaks the atmospheric part of the sort of experience that you might think they're going for. But the biggest thing is what it's trying to do is have its cake and eat it. It's trying to say, well, let's have the tension of the old games, albeit in a much more playable sort of form. And I could certainly attest to that. While it does go for the tension, you've still got the controls working well. You've still got a situation where you don't have to worry very much about inventory management or typewriters or, you know, the savings or.
Do you have any increments? Oh, you don't have any increments.
No, exactly.
That's the worst.
But you're going from the ship parts then to the outside. You're trying to say, well, let's have both the tension and the all out action. And it's a good idea. I like the idea better than I like the execution, because the outside chapters, which are action heavy, just aren't that good. I mean, first of all, we talked about previously, well, it can offer up some of the locational variety that you kind of take away from yourself, perhaps, if you're going to set it all on this ship and you're going for the claustrophobic thing. Well, the problem is that a lot of these chapters actually reuse locations quite a lot themselves.
Okay.
So you really don't see a whole bunch of different places outside of the confines of the ship. So they don't really succeed in that way. And then in the other department, in terms of how satisfactory it is from an action point of view, I mean, they're okay. You know, as I said, it's sort of liberating compared to the main game because you basically start off with a full kit. You've got multiple weapons with tons of ammo, far more than you'd be used to play with. But the enemy variety and the scenarios just aren't that particularly creative. That, you know, once you're doing one of these for the third or fourth time in the flow of the story, it does feel a bit like going through the motions.
My interest is really dwindling the longer you talk about this game. And I heard a lot about it on the A4 podcast. I'm really starting to feel like this, you know, I mean, the idea that they're going for having it be more like the older Resident Evil games, that's a huge red light for me because I did not like Resident Evil at all until the fourth game.
Well, I played Resident Evil 2. That's the only one that I played of the old style, and I didn't really care for it very much. And I would say that the portions on the ship are far more entertaining than those, mainly because the gameplay is just far more solid. For me, some of the highlights have been the bosses, but there's not that many of them. And they don't have the kind of epic scale of some of the things in Resident Evil 4. I mean, it's something you could probably say for the whole game, even you're taking into account some of those exterior kind of chapters with the siege sections. Never does it feel like it's on the scale of sort of Resident Evil 4 or Dead Space, you know, that have some of these massive set pieces. I mean, they're set pieces and they're good, but there's nothing quite that gives you the sense of it being, you know, really sort of colossal.
Right.
And I don't think that's a product of the fact that it's on a portable, on a little screen. I think it's just they didn't construct set pieces that were quite that impactful.
Yeah, I mean, on the one hand, you can say, well, you shouldn't expect it to be as epic as Resident Evil 4. It's a handheld game, but it's quite clear that they are going for at least, you know, some kind of simulacrum of a console experience here.
Or at least they've sold it as such.
Well, sure they did, you know, and they tried to price it as such, too, and eventually went back on that. But, you know, I feel like when you clearly aim to do something very ambitious like this game, you also set expectations very high. And, you know, people are willing to put up with a lot of shallowness, repetitiveness, simplicity in handheld games that they're not in a console game. And, you know, PSP struggled with this for its entire lifetime. But once you start to blur that line, you get into a real nasty gray zone of, like, is the fact that it's handheld, is that enough of an asset to make up for some of the shortcomings that also come because it's a handheld game? So this is really just the first example. There will be many others on 3DS, and it will continue on Vita as well. But it's an interesting thing. I guess, I don't know, this sounds more and more like a game that I would have to really play someone else's copy before. And I'd like to see maybe some more of the advanced areas in the game beyond the demo to really decide if I would want to play through the whole thing.
Yeah, I mean, I've really enjoyed it, to be fair. I mean, now, it's no disgrace to not be quite up there with Resident Evil 4, because that is, you know, is a strong contender for our game of the decade. I think most people
absolutely
would consider it to be quite remarkable.
But it is a game of essentially the same format, and it's coming out 7 years later. So if it doesn't even really approach what Resident Evil 4 accomplished, I would say it should.
Well, I think one of the issues is that in terms of gameplay development, I have not replayed Resident Evil 4 at all. So my memories are, you know, nearly 7 years old. But I never really felt in Resident Evil 4 that the gameplay development was necessarily what drove it, but it was the continuing changes in the scenario. And I mean, in this case, because of the locations and also the enemy types, it's weaker in that sense. So no doubt, you know, it does not develop in the same way. And then on the other hand, it doesn't have some of the development that you get in something like Dead Space. So some more like puzzle solving kind of aspects to it, or, you know, things like that.
A lot of environment manipulation in Dead Space.
Precisely, yeah. There's mm-hmm. nothing that cerebral going on here.
Yeah.
So it's quite a straightforward game, and it's executed mostly quite well. I would say it's just lacking a little bit of something extra to kind of put it over the top as something that's really outstanding, you know, a must play. But I'd be surprised for most people if they've enjoyed this sort of third-person action game. You know, I'd be surprised if they didn't enjoy it, because it is very well done.
Okay, well, I think we spent plenty of time on that. So, James, you're up next.
So, it might be better if Johnny starts off, because I probably haven't played as much, but I've been trying to get through L.A. Noire about 4-ish hours in.
We're probably exactly the same place. I've played about 3 to 4 hours of it.
Yeah, so I'm not real far in. What I have found to be kind of weird about it is that I spend so much time driving in this game that it's kind of like I don't want to play it right when I come home from work after I just spent so much time driving. My first thought when I was playing it was I was thinking about the really terrible true crime streets of LA, because you just drive from place you just drive from place to place investigating things, and then occasionally somebody will come on your police radio and say there's X crime going on somewhere, I need to go stop it.
And do the crimes always move the story forward, or are some of them just there to give you points or something?
Yeah, some of the crimes are just kind of there, and they're totally optional. You can just drive right past them. So
yeah, that's what I've done. I have not taken any of the side things, because I'm already dealing with a crime. I'm out doing something that is presumably more important, so
I've been dealing with them, but I mean, a lot of times it's like you're going on the way to investigate a murder, but it just so happens that along your path you just happen to be about 2 blocks away from an ongoing bank robbery.
Yeah.
It really makes me wonder, A, the efficacy of the LAPD, and B, if they really should probably hire some more officers.
Well, the efficacy is up to you, isn't it? I mean, you are the LAPD.
Well, I mean, the efficacy of the remainder of the LAPD.
Oh.
Present company excluded.
See, I mean, I don't know if you've figured this out, James, but you don't actually have to drive in this game most of the time.
I know, you could have your person drive you.
You can have your partner do it, which basically they'll usually sort of say something while they're driving, and then it'll just blank out to a loading screen, and then you'll be there. So you can basically just skip all the driving parts, which is great, because they're using the kind of standard Rockstar GTA-style car simulator physics, and they're horrible. And
well, actually, you know, I would say, having driven a car from the 1950s before, those physics are actually 100% accurate. That is what those cars
feel
like.
Well, in that case, that's just a lucky coincidence for them, because that's also how the cars in GTA 4 feel, and they're in the modern day.
Yeah, well,
I think
I know.
The driving in GTA games is uniformly horrific, and I think it's equally bad in L.A. Noire, except here it's totally optional. So it's not 100% optional. Sometimes you get in a mission, you have to chase someone, or you have to like tail someone, you know, without getting too close. And those parts are not very good, I have to say. I mean, because the driving is really bad. But they seem to be a pretty small part of the game, so I'm okay with it.
The game feels a little bit confused to me, because in the first few hours, it's just introducing all these game mechanics, but it's not really doing a great job. It's just sort of, there's this text in the top left of the screen that you may read, or you may be too focused on the fact that someone is currently shooting at you to realize that text right there is telling you how you fire back at them.
Yeah, I mean, the shooting seems really easy. The chase, the running chases seem really easy. The car chases seem really easy. To me, that all that stuff is sort of window dressing, and it's meant to spice up the game, but none of it seems to be very challenging, at least so far. I mean, I'm just as early
as
you.
I would say the running actually can be kind of challenging because your character handles like your car.
Have you failed?
He sort of leans into corners and... No, you don't fail, except for there's one early-ish in the game where the game tells you about shooting a suspect on the run.
Mm-hmm.
It tells you how to shoot while you're running. But then when you go to do that, it says, the suspect has been injured. Failed. It's like, wait, what?
Maybe
F
you're supposed
you,
to
game?
Shoot at his feet. Like, just shoot the asshole.
No, I shot him in the leg. You're not supposed to shoot him at all. You're supposed to just keep running until you catch him.
No, but I mean, maybe you could shoot near him to scare him without actually hitting him.
I don't know. I eventually there's a scripted event that there's a car accident and you can catch him. But it's like, wait, what? Why did I fail? I did what you told me.
Well,
to.
Well, none of this is really important. I mean, I think the game is about story. It's about characters talking to each other and gauging. I mean, it's about evaluating people's faces when they speak. It's weird to me also. I mean, I seem to be getting more into the groove of it, but like for the first few cases, I did really horribly on these interrogations.
Yeah, some of them are just blatantly obvious. Like, they'll look to the side for like 30 seconds and look back at you. Like, really?
Yeah.
Come on, game.
Some of the facial expressions are not subtle at all. But I finally realized that you should only say they're lying if you literally have evidence that contradicts it. Otherwise, it's basically either you think they're telling the truth or you doubt them because they're doing some facial tick. And it's not very deep, but it's sort of engaging, and it does really make you listen to them and pay attention to them as they're talking. Like, you can't tune it out because that is the game.
Right.
And I think in that sense, it's effective. It doesn't matter if it's difficult. It actually doesn't seem to matter even really if you get it correct or not. The game just kind of goes on either way. But it keeps you involved in the conversations, and it makes you pay more attention to it. And the voice acting is extremely good. The facial animation is kind of mesmerizing. I mean, just really, really, really amazing stuff. And the writing seems to be generally very good as well. And, you know, it's interesting. There's a bit of choose your own adventure in these, you know, within these sort of small cases, because there's a lot of content in there that you may or may not find before you finish the case. Because there's a lot of stuff that you don't actually need to find. There's evidence that's kind of stashed around the different environments. There's information that you might get from an interrogation if you choose the correct option, but you may not get it if you choose the wrong one. And you don't need any of that stuff to finish the case, but if you do get it, it's more enlightening and it explains why people behave the way they did a lot better. And it's interesting how all that stuff is pieced together to create these interactive narratives. But I think the storytelling is really good, and that really seems to me to be the main reason to play it, and also the main place where they spent all their effort. So I've been enjoying it in that sense.
Yeah, the game itself feels like they just took all the murder and mayhem out of a GTA game, in terms of, and you actually play the game. It's the interview sections that's really the only thing that separates the two.
Yeah, but the interview sections make up most of the time that you play the game.
Well, only if you skip everything.
If you skip the driving.
But if you skip driving, you also miss many of the mini-quests.
Well, I am completely fine with that.
Now, do you foresee the interview sections actually holding up over the course of the game, or do you think you'll just eventually get tired of them?
I would say it's entirely dependent on what they're doing in them. Like, if it's just the same old kind of conversations, then I could see them getting old. But if they're actually telling a story, that would be different.
Yeah, I mean, so far I've mostly been interrogating housewives, you know, like backstabbing, you know, her husband's cheating on him, so she tries to have him killed or, you know, whatever. There's been a lot of that stuff so far. I'll be interested to see if you move into, you know, interrogating mob bosses, street thugs, and trying to get intel on, you know, their fellow criminals from them. I mean, if the clientele, if the environments and the kinds of people that you're dealing with change, if you have to go to jail and interrogate an inmate, that is really intriguing to me. And I wouldn't necessarily think that that's an exciting prospect before playing this game, but seeing the structure that they built up and the mechanics of it, now I'm really kind of curious to see where they take it.
Yeah, with people that might be a bit harder to interrogate.
Right, like people who have more to lose. or they're not the kinds of, they're not as well-known kinds of characters, I guess. That to me, that's really interesting. And also just hearing their sides of stories and hearing what they have to say. I mean, I think to me, the best thing about LA Noire so far is the presentation is so good. I mean, not just the face graphics and everything and the voice acting, but I think the way that the menus are set up and the logos that come in to introduce a new case and how every scene starts out in black and white and then it fades to color. They really nailed the style of old film noir, and I love that stuff. I mean, I'm a big fan of that. So to me, it's really a delight, and the whole game oozes style, and it's a style that you've never really seen in video games before. So I appreciate it very much on that level.
I'm honestly just not feeling it that yet. I mean, I don't want to skip big chunks of the game because I actually think their recreation of the city is very interesting, and it's the city is kind of the character of the game. So if you're skipping it, kind of like, well, F that. I hate this character.
But you don't have to see it from the street. I mean, you still see the world they've created in the course of doing the cases, in the course of walking around looking for clues, going into people's houses and seeing the decor in there and talking to them. To me, the world building of it is not lost by skipping the driving. You know, I mean, you go watch a film noir, they don't have to show every drive that every character does to get to every single place in order for you to get a sense of where that movie takes place. I think it's a pretty cool game. I will be playing a lot more of it for sure. All right, John, so what do you have for new business?
All right, after hearing about it from several different sources, including, I believe, you, Johnny, I picked up Bastion. It was half price on Xbox Live Arcade.
Ooh.
And it reminds me a lot of Torchlight. That's the first game that came to mind when I started playing it.
Huh.
I mean, it's really, really cool. I haven't gone too far into it at all. I mean, I just bought it one morning and played as much as I could before I went to work. But it immediately sucks you in, just because of the way it puts your path down before you as you walk through the world. And so it's just really interesting. And I mean, the voiceover is absolutely great. It really surprises me that something like that hasn't been done previously to this.
Right.
And it surprised me because it's something like if you told somebody that that's done in the game, they'd be like, okay, so what? Some guy talks over your actions and kind of spells out what you're doing and tells you what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
But it's really cool because it actually gives kind of a slight background to what you're trying to do in the game. Like, you know, everybody that you used to know has been turned to these piles of dust that you can go through and knock over and stuff like that.
It's like John's high school reunion. Everyone's already turned to dust.
What you find is that it turns out the game has a lot deeper backstory and a much more rich world than you would have expected from the fact that it's a download game, you know, and it's made by a very small indie developer. And the nice thing about the narrator is that it lets the game provide a lot of information to you about this world without ever making you go through a cutscene. The characters never mm-hmm. even really talk to each other, you know, even though there are multiple characters in the game. And so it never interrupts the action. You're always moving forward. You're always bashing through enemies. You're always rolling around and looking for secret items. And the game just keeps giving you all this information over the top of that. And the narrator is kind of the natural way to do that. And the voice acting for the narrator is really damn good. So that helps.
Yeah, I mean, always dropping little hints like, this is so-and-so, he never did like her, but he respected her, or something. He'll say like little things like that, but in kind of a way with like just the right amount of cheeseballishness that, you know, kind of makes it endearing. Like, it's sort of almost like a Clint Eastwood kind of thing or something like that. But, you know, like I said, not too far into it, but I'm really looking forward to playing through it.
Yeah, it's an awesome game. You're going to love it. Okay, well, I will wrap up new business here. I've got a couple of things. First off, I'll mention a Nintendo game that I played. Actually, it was just last night. Our friend Michael TYP Cole was visiting here in Colorado. Unfortunately, he could not extend his trip long enough to do the show with us. But we played Smash Brothers, as always, when we're together. That's the only time either one of us really ever gets to play it. And it was pretty epic. We only played it for like maybe an hour. But it did end with me blowing him off the stage with a Super Wario atomic fart Final Smash. So that seemed like a very fitting way to end the evening. But before that, we Street Passed, of course, and we also played some Zelda Four Swords from the anniversary thing where Nintendo gave it out for free. And he had not played it at all, not this version. He had played the original GBA version a little bit when it first came out. And I had only played through maybe one world by myself and found that it was not something I really wanted to play by myself. So this was when he suggested, I said, oh yeah, awesome, let's do it. And so we did, and it was interesting. It was one of the very first times I've done local multiplayer on 3DS, actually. And the first time I've played Four Swords multiplayer, at least the handheld version. I played the GameCube Four Swords Adventures a little bit multiplayer, a little bit. But this was definitely a different experience, and we had a pretty good time overall, but I think the level design in this game is going through the numbers a little bit. It's going through the motions. You know, they have, to me, there's not a lot of originality in the way that the puzzles are put together, the way that the environments are laid out. And also because they're essentially these giant mazes that you run through with another character, it doesn't really feel like a traditional Zelda environment. The structure of it and the way that you proceed through it is so different that it really kind of lacks that classic Zelda feel. And it's weird because you're still doing a lot of the same things you do in Zelda mechanically. You're still swinging your sword at enemies and cutting down bushes to collect rupees and stuff like that. But all of that stuff ends up feeling kind of artificial because the part underneath it, you know, the way that they're all arranged and put together, it's kind of lacking that soul that you expect from a real Zelda game. And as we were playing it, TYP kept saying, I bet this was made by Tosei. Because, and I don't know if it's true, and, you know, maybe nobody does, because the legend about Tosei is that they're not allowed to say which games they've made. And I really don't know.
I was under the impression that Flagship developed it.
Yes.
Because they were called, originally it was bundled together with the Link to the Past port. So it's always been kind of a throw-in. You know, obviously we got it for free as part of the celebrations now, but it was, you know, something back then, it was pretty much a Nintendo's consistent MO. Some Mario Advance games would come out, a, you know, port of a Super Nintendo game, mm-hmm. and you got that Mario Brothers Versus thing, and this was basically sort of the Zelda equivalent. But then, of course, they kind of furthered it when they got to Four Swords Adventures on GameCube with connectivity, and I assume, having never played it, that it really takes the ideas on and it probably feels a bit more deliberately designed than this does.
Yeah, I mean, I've played through all of Four Swords Adventures on GameCube by myself. I actually had a Japanese copy of it, and that was interesting to actually get through the game and solve all the puzzles in Japanese. But I think Four Swords Adventures is a really fun, it's almost like a fan remix of Link to the Past. You know, it has kind of that feel. It's a lot of the same elements, but they sort of remixed it in the craziest possible way. And for the most part, it's very well done. And it does have some of the same problems of that, you know, the structure isn't quite the same. But overall, I felt like it was a very high quality experience to go through. And I also felt like, you know, because it was designed from the beginning to support a single player mode, the levels are kind of laid out in an intelligent way to take advantage of that. So, of course, you can play it four players, but if you're playing it by yourself, you're using four links, and you arrange them in formations, and you do some pretty crazy stuff with them, and that in itself is kind of its own intellectual challenge and a satisfying way to play the game. Of course, Four Swords, the original on GBA, was not meant to be played by single player, and they only added that functionality now with the free download version. And so I feel like this game, when played by yourself, really isn't very much fun at all, because it wasn't really meant to ever be played that way. It's a nice thing that they let you try it, but that's really not a good way to play it. But even in two players, you know, there were moments of fighting certain enemies where we realized that we had to, there's the one enemy that you have to both get on either side of it and pull it in opposite directions in order to kill it. It took a long time for us to figure that out because there's very little indication that that's how you would deal with that enemy. But once we finally figured it out, I thought, well, that's actually really neat. You know, that is an enemy that you can only kill with two people. And it uses the pulling mechanic that's been in Zelda for a long time, but I've never quite seen that done before. And I thought that was really neat. But then there's a lot of other stuff where the game really is just kind of unimaginative and a little bit clumsy. And the music is horrible. I don't understand what they were thinking with the music in this game, but it's really bad. There's one level, which one we were playing, the cave level. And the music is really like 5 notes long and just repeats on this endless loop. And it's really, really annoying. And of course, if you both have your volumes up, what you'll find is that it's in sync at first. And then the longer you play, the more out of sync it gets. So at some point, one of you is going to have to turn your volume down because you just can't handle it anymore. But then every time both characters have full life, you go into Rupee Fever, which makes any rupee that you pick up worth twice its normal value. And the music for Rupee Fever is amazingly irritating. And it happens pretty often. So we were both pretty disgusted with the sound design for this.
Yeah, I can only imagine it's a question of how big of a or small of a production it was. Because again, I mean, you look at Flagship with Minish Cap on the same hardware. That's a very good GBA soundtrack.
Yeah, and I hate to complain about a free game because I do appreciate Nintendo giving this out, and I think it's a really neat gesture, and the fact that they really did re-engineer it for DSi and 3DS, so that it uses both screens and it uses all 4 face buttons, and you can play it by yourself now. I think all that is really great. I just don't think it's that good of a game, and that's a shame. But I'm not really surprised, but I was, you know, I kind of thought, well, playing it with another player is going to be, that's going to be really fun. You know, that's automatically fun. And there are aspects of it, and there are moments of really great joy, you know, of doing something together or of competing with each other and, you know, one person screwing the other one over to get to the rupees first. I mean, there are moments that are golden, but there's also, it feels like there's a lot of filler.
I think it actually culminates that, what you're describing there, if you actually take the time to play to the retro stages, which you know, don't have such irritating music, although I think Rupee Fever is still in effect, but they are ridden with kill rooms.
Really?
That is, you want to talk about filler, that is a lot of what you're doing is just, all right, kill everything until it stops, and then move on, you know, and I'm sure TYP, that would drive him mad. One of his bugaboos about game design and stuff. So, and again, those are the additional levels that were put into this version of what was originally kind of a throw-in game, and I think you're kind of seeing that totem pole in effect in terms of how much thought was put. You know, it's a nice touch to sort of journey across, you know, all these different Zelda aesthetics to tie into the 25th anniversary, and you get the music and all that, but those levels are another step down in terms of how considered they are in terms of level design.
Well, we considered, well, so I had already beaten the forest level. He had not played the game before that. So together we beat the lava world and we beat the cave world. And I would then be able to go on to the dungeon where you try to go find Vati. And then, you know, at some point after that, we would have unlocked the retro levels. And we might have actually gone ahead and played through one more world in order to unlock the retro levels. But the game actually wouldn't allow him because he didn't have the key from the forest level. So we would have had to go back, and I would have had to go through that entire level again just so TYP could get credit for it, and then we could proceed on together to the part that neither of us had played yet. And we're like, no, we're not going to sit here for another 2 hours and play more of this mediocre Zelda game. Let's play Smash Brothers. So anyway, it was an interesting experience. I found it a little disappointing, actually, but I would play the game again, especially with 3 or 4 players. I think, you know, just at some point, the interaction among all the different people playing really kind of overwhelms whatever the game itself is, and it almost doesn't matter if the game is sort of a little bit lackluster. I think you'd still have a really good time with it. But for 2 people, we sat there and we were not wanting to be, but we were both kind of being pretty critical of what we were doing in this game because, you know, it just, there wasn't enough chaos to overcome the fact that it's not a real Zelda game. So anyway, the other thing I played this week, other than I finally broke 100 stars in Galaxy 2, so I'm slowly but surely creeping up towards my goal there of maybe actually finishing that game. But I finally started Shadow of the Colossus on the HD collection. So I talked about Eco back in the fall when I first got the set. And I've been wanting to get into Shadow for a while. But this game, I have actually already played all the way through back on PS2 back in 2005, I guess. It wasn't quite as mysterious to me as Eco was, because I'd never actually beaten Eco. Shadow's a known quantity for me, but it's a game that I liked a lot the first time I played it. And so I finally started playing the HD version. I got through about 4 Colossi, so I guess I'm about a fourth of the way through the game. And I have to say, it looks really fantastic on PS3. They've done a great job of not only making the game HD and upsizing the textures and everything, so it doesn't look exactly like a PS3 game, but it definitely does not look like a PS2 game. Having played Eco on PS2 fairly recently, before the HD collection came out, I can tell you that this is a huge step above the PS2 version, and it looks really good overall, and they smoothed out the frame rate a ton, which was a massive problem in the original release. I mean, that game was way too much for the PlayStation 2 to handle. So the game just plays overall, it looks and plays a lot more smoothly and a lot better in the HD version. But the controls are still pretty bad. I mean, I remembered finding them pretty frustrating and kind of gritting my teeth and getting through the game despite that. But they certainly did not tweak them in the HD version. They are the original controls, and they're pretty frustrating. There's just so many cases of, you know, you're climbing up on these giant monsters and you're trying to stab them and you're trying to hold on. And in some cases, they require you to do some fairly precise movement around the monster as you're climbing around it, you're grabbing onto its fur, and you're trying to get to a very specific place so you can stab it in its weak point. And your character just does not do what you want him to do. I mean, you couldn't be more clear about the direction that you're pushing the joystick to make him go that way, and he just won't do it. He just goes off in whatever other direction. There's also a lot of, like, weird animation timing, so sometimes when you tell him to do something, he won't do it because he was, like, maybe in the middle of doing something else when you push the button, and it won't cue it up. There's just a lot of things about it. It's just like really kind of textbook. It's like the anti-Miyamoto. This guy's, you know, Ueda, the guy who directed these games and directed Last Guardian, if that ever comes out. He's a really brilliant guy, and these games are very interesting, very emotionally involving, very beautiful, very epic. There's so much to be admired here, but he does not understand how to do game controls at all. And that's why I would love for him to work with Miyamoto, because I think you combine their powers and there's no telling what they would produce. It would be without flaw. But as it is, this game's pretty flawed. And yet, I still think it is totally worth putting up with not very good controls, because everything else about the game is so good. And it's a pretty amazing experience. And this game's only 7 years old, but like Resident Evil 4, has already become very influential, not only on, you know, other Sony games, but on Zelda, which is very much the inspiration for it in the first place. I mean, you know, a lot of concepts went from the Zelda series to Shadow of the Colossus, and now they've been carried back into the Zelda series. So, you know, if you're a huge Zelda fan, I think you need to play Shadow of the Colossus. It's part of the DNA of the franchise that you love. And it's a really weird kind of bizarro world version of a Zelda game, where it has so much in common with Zelda, and yet so much of it is completely different and really defies your expectations of what you would be doing in a game like this. You know, there is no dialogue, there are no characters to talk to, there are no shops to enter, there's no money, there are no regular enemies, there are no heart containers, there are no upgrades. It's all bosses all the time, and there's a huge, barren, almost post-apocalyptic world. I mean, this world that you ride around in to look for the Colossi, it feels like people used to live there and now they don't. I mean, it feels like it has a history that you will never understand. And it's very evocative, and it's very morose experience to ride through this place. There's no music as you ride around. All you hear are the horse, the footsteps of the horse, and the wind blowing through the air. And yet you find these amazing environments, these huge vistas, these cliffs. I mean, has a lot of the same appeal as Xenoblade, you know, of sort of stepping over a crest and seeing this huge expanse of territory in front of you for you to explore. And yet there's really nothing to find if you explore. That's not the point. It's a world that maybe 1,000 years earlier was full of treasure chests and little caves and little goblins running around for you to kill, but not anymore. The only thing left are you and the Colossi. And the game has such a purity of focus. I think it's a very special experience. So good job by Sony. I am really, really interested in The Last Guardian. And I think this is the year. If it doesn't come out this year, then it may not ever come out.
Yeah.
So we'll see. But I think anything this guy touches, you should keep your eye on, because there's going to be something special about it for sure. Okay, well, that's going to wrap up our new business segment. So we're going to take a much-needed break. And when we come back, we've got retroactive number 21, focusing on Fire Emblem, The Sacred Stones. Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com.
We begin this week with reviews, the first coming from Andrew Brown for One Piece Gigant Battle. And no, there's not a syllable missing from that. We are on a cruise, but does it sink or swim?
What the hell is that, James?
That was the mating call of the Gigant, apparently.
It's actually a boss in Resident Evil 4.
Next up in their review trade is Sakura Samurai Art of the Sword for the 3DS eShop from Neil Ronahan. Cherry blossoms are really pretty, but their inclusion doesn't make this a great game, apparently.
And the review train just keeps chewing along.
Shut up!
With a review of F1 2011 for 3DS by Zach Miller, in which he says, "Your mileage may vary."
Oh!
And we have another review for LEGO Harry Potter Years 5 to 7 on Wii by James Charlton, and he says, "This Harry Potter isn't a stud in LEGO Hogwarts."
But he was in real Hogwarts.
Wow, okay. We have impressions of Rhythm Heaven Fever for the Wii by Aaron Kaluska, in which he makes up a word and then says, "Yes, Rhythm Heaven Fever continues the series' excellence."
Wubba dubba dubba, is that true?
No. We also have a feature from Danny Bivens, our weekly Japan eShop Roundup. There is a demo for the 999 sequel, another Theater Rhythm demo, and Punch-Out, all on the same day.
And finally, we have something called the Resident Evil Glossary by Andrew Brown. It's a good way to catch up with Resident Evil terminology to coincide with the launch of Revelations, a series well known for inventing its own words, obviously. So if the vocabulary of this franchise makes you feel at sea, then feel free to go catch up in the glossary.
I am going to go kill something.
Yes, you can catch all this amazing original content and the latest...
Honestly, it's a lot better than we make it sound.
And the latest news, podcasts, etc. over at NintendoWorldReport.com.
Can you hear that, dear listeners? That is the sweet sound of the Fire Emblem theme as orchestrated for the Super Smash Bros. Brawl soundtrack. But I must tell you that this pleasant little musical interlude is in fact a devious bit of cover for delivering some bad news, as what you won't be hearing in the next segment is the sweet sound of John Lindemann's voice, as his audio was lost to a technical fault, and so I had to cut the segment accordingly. However, there is still rather a lot of Fire Emblem-related content in the upcoming retroactive feature, so I hope you enjoy it, and without further ado, it's over to Johnny.
Okay, so yes, we are back to talk about Fire Emblem The Sacred Stones. It's retroactive number 21. You voted on the game, you played it, you posted.
You better have played it, you ass!
And now we're going to talk about it. I have a litany of forum quotes here. We're not going to get through them all, but I will read as many as I can, as many as we can get to, as the conversation steers us around all the different elements of this game. And I do want to thank everybody who has been participating. So, to get started, I thought it would be good to go around and sort of find out what our respective levels of familiarity are with Fire Emblem. This game, I believe, is Fire Emblem 8, if you go by the complete Japanese lineage. And as of now, there have been at least 10 or 11 currently. So it is one in a very long line of Fire Emblem games, including a couple of remakes and ports. So this was certainly my first time playing a Fire Emblem game for any length of time. Before this, I'd only played a demo for the GameCube title back at an old Nintendo Press event, and that was several years ago, even now. So this was really my first true experience with Fire Emblem. And Greg, what about you?
This is my first Fire Emblem game. It was always the one I kind of looked at as being where I would probably get into the series because, first of all, it was much more obtainable than its GBA predecessor, which was the first game that came to the Western market, simply called Fire Emblem, which was really well reviewed. I mean, that's really where, you know, my interest sort of got piqued. You know, obviously it had the first, probably that I really heard of the series was the characters in Smash Bros. Melee to start with. And then a few years later, they bring over the first game in the series ever to hit the Western markets on GBA, and that gets great reviews. So I was kind of interested. And then, you know, the sequel, Sacred Stones, rolls around, and there was talk about, you know, it's pretty much the same, but in fact they'd put a few more things in to make it more inviting for people who hadn't played any of these types of games before. You know, the fact that you could grind, essentially you could kind of build up characters outside of the standard missions, essentially give yourself a kind of a leg up on the curve, things like that. I thought, well, you know, maybe this would be the one to do it, but I never actually did buy it. This is my first time experiencing the game and experiencing the series at all, but I am now more familiar with the whole tactics or strategy RPG genre than I would have been had I bought it at the time that it came out.
Thanks primarily to Retroactive, I assume.
Yeah, we've had Shining Force, we've had Ogre Battle, you know, but also I reviewed Final Fantasy Tactics A2 at John's behest.
Yes.
You know, so I'm much better versed now. So it's interesting how that kind of affects your perception of it. I imagine that'll be something we'll talk about as we get through the conversation.
Sure. And speaking of having a little more context, James, this is a genre that we know that you are very familiar with. But what about the franchise itself? Had you played much Fire Emblem before this?
Prior to the Smash Brothers GameCube release, I was aware of the series. So I'd actually played a translated ROM of Fire Emblem Akokuryu to Hikari no Tsurugi, which is the first game.
You are hardcore.
Which is Shadow Dragon and the Blade of Light. Hence the reason the DS remake just took the name Shadow Dragon.
So that was the one that they remade for DS.
Yeah, that is the first Fire Emblem game. It is primitive in the extreme.
Huh.
And then I played the Fire Emblem Game Boy Advance game, or in Japan it's the Sword of Flame, which is actually the second Game Boy Advance game, because Fuyin no Tsurugi came out first, and then I played Sacred Stones, and then I played Path of Radiance.
Okay.
So this is technically my third, although it's the fifth time I'm playing a Fire Emblem game. I never got around to Radiant Dawn because I beat Poor, like, in 2006, and Radiant Dawn came out in 2007. I'm not ready.
And by poor, you mean Path of Radiance.
Yes. Well, generally speaking, if online, somebody will say Fire Emblem, P-O-R.
Yeah.
Yeah. And also, it's best to just take Radiant out of it, because that only makes you confuse them more.
Yeah, because they basically said, all right, let's just make it more Radiant. This is a very Radiant game.
Yeah. Just to briefly get into that, because I know a lot of people were in the forum thread were asking, you know, what game should you play next if you enjoyed this? And I mentioned this to 2IP last night when we were hanging out, and he strongly recommended the GameCube game Path of Radiance. He felt like that was his favorite. He's played probably about the same number of these that you have, James, and he really felt the GameCube was the most fun, the best presentation, the most balanced one to go with.
It's definitely the easiest. I don't mean that derisively. I mean, it's the least unfair. I mean, there are elements in all of these games where it just feels unfair. Like, there'll be an enemy that you just can't get anywhere near because they will one-hit KO everybody in your party. But that game has the least unfair moments of the set. I would say there's a handful where there'll be an enemy that you're basically explicitly told, do not get anywhere near him, he will kill you. And you just have to keep moving your forces away from him. But that's as bad as it gets.
Yeah, so there were a lot of posts regarding difficulty, so it's a topic that we will definitely come back around to in a minute. But first, for those who did not play along, maybe you couldn't find a copy or you didn't have time to, I just want to quickly explain. This is a strategy RPG. The strategy elements of it are very similar to Advance Wars. So if you've ever played an Advance Wars game, you have a pretty good idea of what the map looks like, the way that your units are moved around on the map, and the way that they encounter. And of course, when two units, when one unit attacks the other, it zooms in on a sort of a 2D kind of view of the battle, and you see one character reaching out and attacking the other one. It's sort of in a Pokemon way, so it only sort of does that briefly for the attack, and then you zoom back out to the main map and see the next unit move around. And there are various win conditions, but in general, you want to sort of defeat all of the other all of the units on the other side, or else get to a specific place and seize a gate, for instance. And the style of the game is very much a fantasy, sort of an anime fantasy world in which
it's kind of high fantasy influenced. I mean, there's dragons and wizards and the chivalrous knight on horseback.
Sure, there's some magic.
Yeah, it's very much medieval high fantasy through the anime lens.
Right. The story is generally told through sort of talking head scenes in between battles, or else at the very beginning or the very end of a battle. And the story starts out in a way that I think is pretty typical of this, genre. There's this sort of continent. It's divided up into several different sections, and one of them starts to become very aggressive and starts to try to take over the other one. Very, very similar to the story in Final Fantasy XII, and actually very similar to Ogre Battle 64 too.
I would say that all of the Fire Emblem games, for the most part, follow that general plot line, at least the ones I've played.
You know, it makes sense. I think there's a certain logic in that construct, because what it means is you have this sort of tight-knit world where the dignitaries of several different regions all already know each other. So there are these pre-existing relationships. Some of them are related. Some of them are just friends. Some of them are rivals. And so as you go through the quest, there's all this conflict. There's a war going on, or you're escaping your enemies, or you're moving in to attack the country that invaded you and killed your father.
Who always dies. If you have a father in a Fire Emblem game, he is fucked.
But the characters that you meet along the way, your characters have some kind of history with them. So it's not like you're going into a foreign land where everything is completely new to you. So I think that's the reason. It gives them some sort of pre-existing story constructs to play with as the characters move around on the map and, run into each other.
And it's a story that works well for the mechanic, because they have to explain why you have military station, but at the same time they have to explain why you have a relatively tiny force that is ultimately expanding as you move about the game, because in all of the games you start with the very core retinue. It's usually like the bodyguards, with the exception of Path of Radiance, where you're not actually a noble, you're actually a mercenary, and you're serving as the bodyguards. But it's a very small core group of soldiers that are very, very loyal to their lord. And then as the game expands, you accumulate more forces and try to essentially rebuild a military based on what you had before, which eventually is strong enough to challenge the initial invaders. So they kind of have to hobble you a bit first in order for the game to make sense.
And it also gives you the sense that you're this band of survivors who, you know, if you lose even one unit, it's really a big hit, because you don't have this endless supply of recruits to just add more people to your party all the time, right? So it makes you feel your people are a precious resource, because there aren't many of you left to fight the rebellion, you know, to be the rebellion.
You're essentially waging a guerrilla war, so you really can't afford to have losses. I mean, it's...
Oh, you can afford it.
You can, but I mean, that's the psychology of it. It's like you really have to protect everything. Because
yeah, they want you to feel that way.
Because, you don't know when that mage is going to come in handy. I mean, you're like, oh, I lost my light mage. I am boned. But at the same time, because it is this, every member of your army has a characterization. I mean, there's no anonymous soldier here. I mean, they may not be good characters, but they have a plot. They have a story. They have interaction with other members of your party. I mean, everybody there knows someone else. Like, they'll have brothers in your army, sons. I mean, there's a connection to everyone. So everybody has a reason to come with you. So it kind of makes losing them a bit upsetting, because you're gonna miss how the story plays out for them. Although nobody dies, they just get hurt, and they never heal, apparently, because apparently this war can go on for years, but nobody is freaking healing. Which is weird, because you have mages who all they do is heal people from the brink of death. But yeah, if you lose someone who's not story-centric, which means you just don't lose the game, from that point on, they might still be in the plot, but they'll just talk about how they can't fight.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I haven't really seen that. I lost a lot of characters early on in the game when I didn't really know what I was doing. I didn't really have a feel for the kinds of tactics that you need to use in this particular game. And those people have not come up.
It depends on how integral they are, I think. Like, if you lose one of the knights, I think they'll keep coming up. But if you lose one of the knights, you're boned anyway, so you should just restart.
Well, one of the most interesting things about Fire Emblem, and we have a couple of good forum quotes here about it, but I wanted to get into the question, the philosophy of restarting battles because you lost a unit. That's the famous thing about Fire Emblem, is that if one of your units dies on the battlefield, you cannot bring them back. There are no Phoenix Downs. And if you lose a unit, they're gone forever. You can never have them back. And that leads a lot of people to the feeling that they should just immediately restart a battle and go back to the last save point every time that happens and play through the game sort of in a perfect way. So Sarek posted in the forum thread, "My progress has been slowed in this game simply from how many times I get unlucky at the end and have to redo the mission all over again." Note, he uses the language, "have to redo the mission all over again."
Well, it depends on how unlucky you get, because if somebody comes through and knocks out a plot-driven character, I mean, you really do have to
If you lose Erica, then yes, you would literally have to restart. You would have no ability. But I would guess what he's actually referring to is that one of his cherished characters who he did not want to lose was killed near the very end, and he felt obliged to restart, although it is voluntary. You could continue on.
You could, but it might not be advisable.
Well,
it really do have to do a cost-benefit analysis on that.
Yeah, there were plenty of opinions available on that. So KDR11K posted in the thread that he said, "I'm planning to play the game with a no-reload rule. If people die, then they die. Fewer worries that way. I don't see myself getting...
You are screwed!
I don't see myself getting so much into the game that I would regret being able to continue."
He will never beat the game.
Well, and then GLaDOS posted, this is a little bit of a different take on it, but GLaDOS said, "Well, this is my first strategy RPG, and I've got to say, I love it. Now, that's not to say it can't be frustrating at times, but overall, I think that this is a really, really good game. For some reason, getting stuck in it is not as annoying as it is getting stuck in a typical JRPG. I don't know, but it feels like winning is always possible, and that every time you try a map again..." I stress that phrase. "Every time you try a map again, it seems completely different than the last time you attempted it." So it's interesting. The forum thread for this game was full of experts who were very happy to tell you that you're playing the game wrong, just as James is now. And
I'm not saying you're playing the game wrong. I'm just saying if you don't restart and you lose certain characters, you will struggle mightily at the end of the game.
Sure.
Because there are characters the game will let you lose that are almost vital to beating the final bosses.
Yeah, and from reading the forum thread, and I haven't gotten this since from playing the game, but I'm not finished with it either. I'm only up to chapter 12 or 13. But from reading the forum thread, you would get the sense from the experts who've played the game many, many times that there's a lot of stuff that happens later in the game that you can become very ill-prepared for. And
yes,
in order to play the game properly, you almost have to have some kind of foreknowledge of which characters are important later on and what kinds of battles you'll be running into towards the end of the game. And of course, the average person playing this game would not have that foreknowledge. So I thought it was really interesting the way that people reacted. I went into the thread and I said, I want to get as far as I can before we record the retroactive. So I don't have time to restart missions over and over and over again, and I don't have time to grind. I'm just going to keep pushing through. I said, if someone dies, too bad. If I can finish the mission without them, then I probably don't need them for the next one. So I'm just going to keep pushing on. And people seem to get really upset with me for deciding to play that way.
Well, the whole thing of character death being permanent and all that, I mean, really, I kind of had an approach of if I just do something really stupid at the start, like not check one enemy unit's attack range and then lose someone to that early on in a mission, I'm going to restart.
Yeah, which I did too. If something happened very early on, then I would restart. But if I've been playing that mission for half an hour and I lose a guy, too bad.
If someone on the other hand dies gallantly in a great win, you know, at the end, well, then their sacrifice will be remembered. But I did also make me play very conservatively.
Mm-hmm.
And we've got a post about the sort of tension between these two things as well. But, basically what I was doing is I had Seth, the paladin. So he's already an upper class of character that most of your characters are not. So he is very much tougher than everyone else you've got. And so he became the bulwark. There's a lot of these maps, the key to them is choke points.
Yeah.
So he would basically stand in a choke point, protecting everyone else, essentially. And I didn't even really have to aggressively kill people.
No, because the enemies will throw themselves at him.
Yeah, they crash like waves upon the shore and are broken.
That was lovely.
Like, it really is a bit like the Battle of Thermopylae. I mean, you're just like, hold this ground.
Seth is the 300.
Because the biggest difference between this and Advance Wars, in my mind, is just how potent counterattacking is. You know, I mean, in Advance Wars, say, for instance, if you've got like a lesser class of tank and you attack the baddest tank, the Omega tank or something, because you're attacking it and it's just sort of reacting, you might incur like a similar level of damage that you'll receive back. But if that tank were to attack you, it'd probably just kill you straight away. Well, that imbalance doesn't really exist here.
No.
If you get an enemy that initiates a battle with you, you'll just wipe it out as easily as if you initiated it with them.
Right. The outcome is ultimately identical, except the order is different. So if you have a situation where one character will attack twice and do 10 damage 90% of the time, if he attacks, he'll do the same thing on defense. He'll just attack second. And in fact, there's a certain amount of playing the system there where you have to look at enemies, see how much health they have left and how much damage you'll do and say, all right, this guy will nuke the ever-loving crap out of this unit, but I need to get him experience and I should do enough damage to kill him before he gets to counterattack.
Yeah, well, this is the issue, because when you play the way I did, very conservatively using Seth as the tip of the spear and also the sort of defensive wall at the same time, what it means is that he kills an awful lot of stuff, but he doesn't really accrue massive experience from that because he's already...
No, he doesn't!
He's already an upper-class character, and so he's keeping these guys safe, but to what end?
Yeah.
Exactly.
You start to... This is something we talked about with Ogre Battle, where certain units that have been taken down to a low edge, you like the big cat mother that's keeping the prey alive for the kids to kill it.
Right.
This we throw in experience mode to some of those lesser units. And for the first, a good chunk of the game, now I've got up to chapter 19, it's very near the end of the game, seemingly. But for a good chunk of the game, it really was a case of like, well, I am gradually leveling these guys up, but it is very gradual because I'm being so kind of painstakingly conservative with it. So I'm keeping them alive, but they're not that useful, so, you know, you're kind of wondering, but there are key points where, you know, if you could get them up to a certain level and start upgrading their class with items, then they start getting independently useful and you could start having a much more balanced strategy.
But Greg, don't you know you shouldn't upgrade them until they reach level 20? Otherwise you're losing all those levels worth of stat growth.
Yeah, that's F, who cares?
Well, you know, I mean, there was someone that I didn't upgrade until he was level 20, actually, but that was by coincidence.
Oh.
But most of them, it's like level 10, you can, you know, and it gives them a big boost in stats there and then.
It makes them so much more useful because they gain new abilities and new kinds of weapons they can equip. So I found it to be very worthwhile to upgrade them as soon as possible because all of a sudden now that's a crappy unit that I can now make use of in battle.
For me, the way I was playing, I needed that step change in their abilities sooner than later because they weren't exactly very far ahead on the curve as the game had been progressing. And then as time's gone on now, you know, I have been able to play with your multiple kind of little squads of guys going off in different directions and achieving different things. And I've sort of branched out, not just as I've gained a greater appreciation for the way the systems work in the game and all that, but just because I've got more tools in the toolkit with the characters now. Right. So, I mean, I guess in some ways, because of the way I played it to start with, I probably made the game, you know, less enjoyable than it might have been. But then on the other hand, the way the incentives are kind of structured, I doubt I'm the only person that did that. But there is, of course, the other thing that there's this big kind of fork in the road in this game, which is very much encouraging you to kind of play through it again. So if you were going to play through it again, you could really kind of experiment then much more freely with, you know, well, I know what's coming to a large extent, you know, and I don't have to be so painfully conservative. And so I don't necessarily think it's a terrible thing, you know, from a first playthrough point of view. Though whether I will actually play through it a second time is another matter.
Yeah. So I don't generally upgrade until late. I don't wait till level 20. That's absurd. But I kind of do it as need be. So what I've found, generally speaking, is that I kind of gain an understanding of how my units are independently capable of operating within themselves. And I make tactical decisions based on understanding that the enemy AI is not particularly complex. Essentially, they will attack you if they can attack you first. There's a wave that will sort of advance on you, and more will spawn that can advance on you, but effectively you will reach a point where the enemy is in sort of a sort of homeostasis until you give them the opportunity to attack.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're not very aggressive at all.
Right.
I mean, the game is less territorialism like Advanced Wars because there's no capturing of buildings which then feed into a resource management phase. But like I said, you've still got the choke point thing is still kind of critical. But it's relatively easy to secure those points because they are not as interested in sitting on them as certainly I have been.
Right. Their objective isn't to eliminate you. Their objective is to not be eliminated, essentially.
Yeah, and all of this is a bit unintuitive, and we have a great forum quote that Greg referred to earlier from Pixelated Pixies. And this person wrote, "I've always been intrigued by the Fire Emblem series, but for whatever reason, I've always found it difficult to dig into. While playing the Sacred Stones, however, I think I've identified why that is. I realize that it often confounds conventional video game wisdom. With Fire Emblem, the desire to win a battle with as few casualties as possible is tempered by the need to use weaker characters in order to make them stronger and eventually useful. It can be very rewarding when you find this balance, but it can also be a little frustrating."
Yeah, I mean, that is what I had always, before playing this game, was heard as being one of the sort of central characteristics of Fire Emblem that makes it quite unique. But the edge of that is taken off somewhat in this game because of the capacity to grind in these sort of designated places and whatnot.
Yes.
You know, if the actual number of battles itself is fixed,
which it can be in previous games, yes.
Yeah, it was a scarce resource in itself. Well, then the pressure is on you much more to actually provide the opportunities and therefore take the risks involved with doing that to get your lesser characters killing. Because the biggest thing is that you get experience just for being involved in a skirmish at all. But
right.
You get very much more if you deal the killing blow.
It's classic risk-reward.
Yeah, but if you've got this chance to grind later down the road, that shifts the power of that incentive somewhat. Now, having said that, I have done zero grinding, mainly for the reasons that Johnny expressed. I've wanted to just keep going forward as far as possible into the game, you know, to be able to talk about it here. So I have managed to kind of, you know, walk that line without the modifier, without kind of going off the map of using the grinding, but it is there. It's kind of like a safety net, I assume.
Yeah, and I think the interesting thing about the grinding in this game is that it is completely optional. And I mean, you know, Greg just said he's almost beaten the game without having done any at all. I don't feel like I've really needed to grind. The fact that it's there, I feel like, is just, it seems like a lot of people play this game so conservatively, so much more than is actually necessary to succeed. And maybe it's the emotional attachment of having those characters and actually feeling like they don't want to lose them. And so they're willing to grind them up and make them a lot stronger so that they don't have to worry about them so much anymore. But that is completely voluntary. I don't think you actually have to do that to play the game successfully at all. So it's really interesting that so many people seem to feel compelled to do that and to restart the missions over and over again to save every single character, because you don't need to.
No, but I mean, it's like a lot of RPGs in particular, well, if you don't have this character in your party at this point, you can't do this side quest and see this thing and all that. I mean, a lot of right. RPG players have this kind of desire to do everything 100% and see absolutely everything the game has to offer. And so it's not just about kind of keeping them alive, but it's just about sort of seeing every possibility.
Right. Seeing their end game, because these characters do have these kinds of end games where they interact with each other. So if you have certain characters that have survived and you've built up their kind of relationship by having them talk to each other in battle. One thing we haven't spoken about, and I don't want to segue off this, but is that the recruiting mechanic of the game.
Which I don't know anything about.
Intuitively, there are points where you see characters on the enemy side that yes. are being spoken to, and so I think, okay, well, there must be a reason why.
Or there are third-party characters as well.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, you do get those. But, I mean, even enemy characters, I'm thinking, well, look, there's a reason why this seemingly kind of random character is...
Joshua the motherfucker.
...is being highlighted here. It probably means you might be able to pull them to your side. But I just killed them.
And that's kind of a miss, because it's not just a matter of you have to talk to them. You have to use, many times you have to talk to them with a specific character. And the one I just mentioned, Joshua, who's a massive ass, is incredibly powerful. He's a Myrmidon, which is ridiculous. And they turn into sword masters or assassins, which are super ridiculous. I want him very badly, and it took me many times of playing the level to get him. So what you have to do is you have to get Natasha to talk to him. But she can't fight on her own. In fact, she's utterly...
How would you know that she is the one that would need to talk to him?
She says so. She says, I have to go talk to a person on their side at the start of the mission.
Okay.
She says it explicitly. And then they show him like 18 times before the battle starts. It's pretty explicit who they want you to talk to. The problem is that if she gets anywhere near him, she gets nuke blasted because he's incredibly powerful. So... what you have to do is you have to lure him to you and then have her talk to him, but you have to do it with someone he won't instantly kill. And considering he instantly killed Franz like 3 times and Seth instantly killed him, I had to shift people around and have Natasha ready to talk to him immediately, but out of reach of the enemies who would move on her because she's weak. It's kind of like playing chess, because you know what all the moves everyone is capable of. You can look at the board and say, okay, he can get me, he can get me, he can't get me, I can get him with this guy. But you kind of have to offer bait to entice the enemy sometimes to get them to play into your position. There's a lot of moving pieces around to set up a counterattack or to set up what are essentially traps. The AI is very predictable. They will walk into your traps if you let them.
Well, now, James, yeah. I mean, it's interesting to me because, you know, presumably the reason that you would want a really powerful character is it makes the rest of the game easier. But what you just described is probably more difficult to accomplish than actually beating the game. So I wonder, I mean, is the reason you want to do this because the challenge of actually recruiting this guy is a reward unto itself, or because you actually feel like you need to get this character?
Gotta catch them all, that's what it is.
He is exceptionally useful character. He might be one of the maybe 7 or 8 more useful recruitable characters. And the game makes you pay for him. I mean, you have to work to get him. He is difficult to get. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, he is worth it. I remember last time I played through the game when I had him, and he turned into this sort of otherworldly destroying machine. Because he brings a very specific tool set to the battlefield, which is the ability to crit hit with a sword. And having someone who can crit hit with swords, crit hit with axes... are both very important things to have, because we haven't talked about this yet, but there's a bunch of rock, paper, scissors mechanics in the game.
The weapon triangle at the basis yeah. of it, which is the sword, the lance, and the axe.
Right, and there's a comparable triangle with magic. But what's important with that is these sort of mounted knights, the guys on horseback, they're kind of game-breaking because they can hold all 3 weapons, and you can switch them in battle. So they become this sort of omni-tool. But they're not especially good at anything. They're just sort of good in general. But someone like him, Joshua, is exceptionally good at a handful of things. And in specific battles, that becomes a huge blessing. So if you're dealing with a boss who is an axe user, who is got a very high critical rate. Someone like Joshua negates that ability and becomes sort of this balancing tool to make this boss less crazy. But at the same time, you do have to work to get him. But you, since you can anticipate pretty much everything the game is going to do, with the exception of critical hits, you can sort of make the right accounting to deal with him.
It's, I mean, it is important in some ways that you can anticipate things to the extent that there are relatively few luck-based elements in play because of the permanence of death and all that kind of thing. I mean, I think it does play out nicely in that respect. It feels kind of balanced, but yeah, I guess that's where people could have a pretty sickening kind of moment towards the end of a mission where they get critical hit by something right at the end. Because I think that's one of the differences. Say, for instance, with this in Advance Wars, you talk about avoiding restarts or something. I mean, my experience playing Advance Wars games, there's plenty of times where you just lose.
Right,
you have to play it again, especially towards the end, you know, and you don't mind doing that. You start learning things about what's going to happen in the battle. Certain times, both in Advance Wars and here, you'll get additional waves of enemies coming in that you can't anticipate the first time, but then after that, you see it, you know, and you can plan accordingly from going back to the very beginning of the battle. Mm-hmm. But the difference between something like this and Advance Wars is that while you could easily play Advance Wars battle for a long time and lose and then have to kind of do it all again, with this, you can have the battle won. Essentially, you know, your victory becomes pretty much inevitable.
Right.
But one careless move or a critical hit in the wrong direction, and then you lose a character.
And then it's up to you how to react to that.
You may run into a situation where Seth gets critical hit by the boss, and you pretty much have to make a call there because Seth is so incredibly important.
Now, there is one component of the game with respect to characters possibly getting killed that we haven't discussed yet, which is the ability for certain units to actually rescue characters that might be in danger.
I love the rescue mechanic. That is very cool. I've never seen that done in any other strategy RPG. I mean, you don't get that in Tactics Ogre or Final Fantasy Tactics or XCOM or any of the other ones that I've played over the years. And I think the idea that you can actually make a very aggressive move by taking a weaker character and throwing them into the heart of battle and having them do something really wild, but then go in with a character on horseback and pick that character back up and then take them back out of the field. I really like that because it does give you a way to use the weaker, more vulnerable characters and still have them be an effective part of your strategy.
And what it does do is if you've made all the mental calculus, you said, okay, I can put this character here, launch this attack, I'll get two hits, I'll wipe out that enemy, and then I should be safe if they attack me again because they've only got one enemy close enough to hit me. That works great until you get critical hit in the first encounter because yeah. Then all your math is fucked and you can't pull them out. You have to use someone to go get their ass.
But it's really useful then to have a winged unit. You can kind of, the thing about a flying unit is they can hover around in places where they're safe. No
right.
one's going to get them. And then you can be near a bunch of people so that if anyone gets hurt, you could swoop in, save them, and then take them back to a place of relative safety as well.
Yeah, and what's weird about the flying units is both the Rivens and the Pegasus Knights is that maybe I've never found the right strategy for them, but I don't find them to be particularly useful on their own as offensive tools.
A bit more so, like with the, I've got a Falconite.
Right.
Sort of a leveled up one. And I'm pretty conservative again because I like this character's ability to save other characters. So I've been holding on to it for a long time.
Right.
But I pick my spots basically. Where there's an enemy, like say for instance, where sometimes you get like a few of those eyeball monsters together that have got a pretty big range. And so if there's a few of them together, you've got a problem that if you attack one, they'll all gang up on you.
And yeah, and you're boned.
You won't outlast three attacks, but as soon as one is left on their own, it's dead. So just, yeah, you know, that's the way I've done it. And over time, that's built it up to a point where it's, you know, significantly more independently useful now than it was before. So this is the sort of investment reward, you know, that you get with the game.
Right. And when you play it the first time, especially, you don't know these things.
No, you have to just intuit stuff and, you know, hope for the best.
Right. I mean, when you first get Vanessa, you probably just assume she's worthless, because in general, she kind of is at the start of the game. I mean, she's not particularly good in combat. She can do the whole movement thing, which you probably haven't experimented with it very much, because you get her very, very early.
Yeah. I lost her very early.
you get her much earlier than you get Pegasus Knights in most Fire Emblem games. Usually they come up pretty late, and you've already encountered them on your own at some point. In fact, you've never even seen a flying unit before you get her. I mean, this is the first time you see one. Conceptually, if you've never played a Fire Emblem game before, this is new.
Yes.
This is new ground. And what you don't realize, the game does tell you this, but it doesn't, like, do it at the level of warning it probably should, is that keep them the F away from archers. Because the first mission you have her is also the first mission you see archers, and there are a lot of them.
You know, you can get, I think there's, I mean, this one part of the game I've really not exploited, because, it's easy and normal, isn't there? Which, apparently on easy, it says explains more things, which
right.
I wonder how much more, but I could have gone that way, because having not played a Fire Emblem game at all, you know, there's a lot of things that probably could have done with explaining, but I went for normal, just because I thought it would be more expeditious.
Yeah, me too.
And so, a lot of things related to items.
Right.
Going around and visiting
the villages.
Houses, villages, all this kind of stuff, where you might be able to pick up some useful items. For instance, there's a shield that you can equip to flying units so they're not as brutally exposed against archers and things.
Because by default, arrows are just devastating.
Yeah, but that's the point. I mean, you've got some items that you can find that can put some of these trade-offs, some of these strategic weaknesses and strengths more in your favor, but I really haven't done a lot of that because I just wasn't that cognizant of it, you know, all the different shops and the little places you can visit. And I think there's some that the items that are just hidden altogether that you have to find in the weird little bits of the environment. So, yeah, that's kind of more of a... you know, an RPG component that really kind of differentiate it from Advance Wars that I've not really seen, and clearly don't have to, otherwise I wouldn't have got as far as I have.
Yeah, very much a secret thing. I didn't know about it at all.
There are places, towns, where taking specific characters there will yield different results as well. And in many cases, there might be a hint. In many cases, I say there is a hint. I mean, the character might mention they're from this place before the battle. And then it's like, okay, I need to bring them into this battle. There's something here for them. But many times what you get is an item that may be uniquely useful to that character. But sometimes you get something that's awesome. And even in some extreme cases, you get another character, which is sort of like if you're opening up the eggs out of the vending machine, that's the best prize you can pull out of it.
That's the golden egg.
Because literally every character you get, there's no dead weight. Because it's always nice to have that one piece that you can play in a certain circumstance. It may come up twice ever. But you go, I know how to deal with this circumstance. I'm going to bring out my general. The general's a great example of this, because it seems utterly useless, because it's so slow. But it is very, very good at holding a position.
Yeah, that's exactly what happened with me. When I developed that unit, I didn't just have to rely on Seth anymore for choke point holding. He became, you know, he wasn't going to kill stuff as quickly, and I might need to heal him a bit more often, you know, with the guys behind the wall. But yeah, he could do it. And then that opened up, I could use Seth more aggressively.
Yes.
Or you could hold multiple choke points at once. So yeah, these other kinds of investments that really pay off.
Yeah, the general actually at Seth's level, the general is such a force that you could basically just say, okay, I don't know what's going to happen anywhere else on the field, but I will hold this point for the rest of the battle. But they're not useful in a running battle. And there are some battles in this game that essentially devolve into running battles because they keep spawning enemies behind you. A lot of times when you restart a battle, it's because you go into the battle not really getting what the game is going to put you up against. And you say, oh, they're literally just going to run me over in this battle. Okay, I need to change my approach to it altogether.
But then again, I mean, coming from an Advance Wars background, I don't think there's anything wrong with that.
No, I don't think so at all. I'm glad it does that. I mean, really, there's a handful of strategy games that really do that. The mission where they bring in crossbows for the first time, or the ballistas,
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Those things are just ridiculous. I mean,
because they've got a massive range and they're mobile. So it's really a quantum leap in, you know, what the opposition, and then once you can commandeer one, what you are capable of hitting.
And the first time you run into one, I mean, the game warns you. It says, hey, these things are dangerous. You should be aware of them. But until you see what they're capable of, it doesn't sink in. And then you have to start moving your units around them to try to get into a position to take them out.
Or bum rush them, because they have a minimum attack range, don't they? So if you can get really close to them, they can't attack you.
That's where a flying unit becomes useful, because they can actually get right on top of them.
But that's a really cool wrinkle that's only come up once on the path along which I've played. But, I mean, there's a number of things like that. Like, there was the Fog of War mission that I don't know that that's really been repeated. And that the current one that I'm on is played in darkness, so it's very much like the Fog of War. But you've got torches to light up areas and stuff. You know, it does mix things up quite a bit. I appreciate that. Like, there was one mission I played recently where you've got magma on the ground or something. So if you stand in certain spots, you'll get hurt because you just burned from the heat of it and stuff. So you've got to, again, a lot of the time it does boil down to it creates different kinds of choke points or, you know, particular sort of areas that are very important as routes or, you know, places to block off for the enemy. But I appreciate the fact that it does it in a lot of different ways.
So one thing an aspect of the game we haven't really touched upon a whole lot yet is the story. And I think we have a post here from Hey Einstein that will sort of segue us from gameplay to story. I love me some turn-based JRPG action, and I've been wanting to get in on Retroactive for a while, so this seemed perfect. But boy oh boy, this game is walking a thin line between love and hate. I love the look of the game and the way the units control, but I've taken a strong dislike to how stupidly easy to kill some units are and the lack of any kind of resurrection, despite some of the well-put arguments in favor of it in this thread. What I hate, hate, hate is how the story is told through those endless talking head cutscenes. I sit down on my 3DS for a 30-minute lunch break and have to endure this tedium when I want to be playing the game or saving at the end of the level I've just played. Didn't Intelligent Systems realize this was going to be played on a handheld?
But you know, that really wasn't that uncommon in the GBA era. I mean, there was this weird phase where RPGs sort of ceased to exist on the console as it had existed in the past, and it sort of translated down to the GBA. Mm-hmm. It was kind of like this weird phase where The Bouncer was the best RPG on the PS2, and you ended up with like 7 or 8 GBA RPGs that were really superlative, but decided to tell stories just like their SNES counterparts.
Right. They didn't really beg to be played in a portable fashion. And keep in mind, GBA didn't have an automatic across-the-board sleep function like DS does. So
it did have a sleep function occasionally.
Yeah, if the games implemented it. This is actually really good about preserving your progress. I mean, if it was on a GBA, it seems to me, you know, in this case, obviously, because it's on 3DS, the Ambassador program, I'm basically just pressing the menu button on the 3DS and, and getting out of it. But it seems like if you just switched off your GBA in the middle of a battle, you would not lose any progress whatsoever. It saves it, right?
It saves you as of the last turn you ended.
Which it does transparently. I did not even know it was doing that, but we had an interesting forum post about it. So DeJarvis posted, coming back to this game, I realize why I love these games so much. The portability of the game is amazing. This is a complete contrast to the previous post we read. Anyway, continuing on. It really is the only game I can turn off the system, turn it back on, and be right back to where I was before. Most of my gaming is done on the go, and this game still today has one of, if not the best portability of any game. It's one of the few games I can get away with playing at work, and I love the idea of being able to make a couple of turns and turning off the system and get back to what you were doing an hour later.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, obviously, in terms of the gameplay, which is the real meat of it, I would say. You know, it's very well suited for portable play. In terms of the story, I'll admit I probably would have been more tempted to just skip some of this because it's all skippable.
Yeah.
Right.
I didn't skip it because of retroactive, but I came close a couple of times.
You want to see the story because we're trying to experience, you know, all of the game as everyone's playing along is trying to experience all the game as well. So I probably have stuck with it a bit longer than otherwise would. And yeah, it is probably guilty of just taking a bit too long to kind of play out in certain cases. I mean, the story's not altogether uninteresting. It has some amusingly sort of macabre themes, like one case of a mission I recently fought was where you've got a sort of Denethor-like ruler that's clearly gone a bit mental and isn't really doing anything anymore, but the way he's being sort of sustained in this state is the bad guys have like basically created a zombie of his dead wife and stuff. I mean,
it's pretty horrendous.
He's their puppet because they brought his wife back to life, sort of. It's really kind of grim, and there's other examples like that as well. So it's not all kind of twee childish fantasy. It's got a little bit of a darker edge to it, but in the main it's not terribly interesting. The main characters are not especially well developed, you know, because obviously they are the most critical of all. You would think that, and you've got to follow one or the other in the middle act of the game on their own path and stuff. So you'd think you'd kind of get to know them really well, but I don't really feel like they're particularly strong characters.
I would say the game, it just in the straight plot arc, ignoring the flourish of character development, the game does a fine enough job for pretty much any game setting. I mean, it's got the requisite turn the whole reason for this is all happening on its head, exposed motivations kind of thing going on at the end, which is kind of what you expect from these games. But I feel like the game sort of suffers from intelligent systems writing.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the Paper Mario series, I think the story is bad in all of them.
Yeah, Paper Mario could be amusing at times and charming, but there's definitely too much talking.
Yes, yeah. Far. A Thousand Year Door is... There's a chalk outline in Thousand Year Door for some reason.
And they're not the only people that were guilty. I mean, it's like Camelot, you know, like the Mario Golf game that I play. That has entirely too much talking.
Golden Sun is just unforgivable, the amount of text in Golden Sun. I find it to be completely intolerable.
I don't agree to that extent on Golden Sun or 2. I think 2 is actually better than 1 in that respect. But the third game, fuck me. Oh my god.
So in terms of characters talking to each other, we had some forum posts with kind of a different take on this, even though that we did definitely have several posts, including one from 2IP, who said the story is basically not very good. But FrostyBro24 posted, "I just finished The Sacred Stones a few days ago, and it was one of the best video game experiences I've had recently. The branching storyline and its optional scenes based on character relationships and which characters you've managed to keep alive is pulled off spectacularly, yet is at the same time a subtle addition to the game that isn't shoved in your face." And Gajira had a sort of a related post. "Probably my favorite aspect of these games are the characters. The beautiful sprite animation is worth watching even after seeing it over and over again. Also, there's always something satisfying about seeing your characters change class. I also tend to cherish the characters with unique sprites. One feature I never really utilized until later games is placing characters next to each other to form support links. Not only does it give extra character information, but also makes your characters better in battle. It's something I try to take advantage of as much as possible." That's a feature I know nothing about because the game hasn't explained it whatsoever.
Well, it does. There's a menu option to see.
Yeah, I've seen the menu options that talk about what it is, so I know what it is, but I've not got into it.
It's entirely superfluous, but it does have its benefits. Now, I would actually say that some of the character-to-character interaction, especially of the support characters, the guys who live on the periphery, some of that actually can be kind of amusing because you get... I mean, there's one character who has developed this weird habit of watching other characters of a different class, specifically of a different gender. And she spends, if you've done the support links with them, she spends much of the game bouncing between these two characters, just sort of essentially stalking them. But not like, I'm going to steal your clothes stalk you, just sort of like, I think at one point the game refers to affectionately as monk watching, because she spends literally time just sort of gazing longingly at these two characters. And it's a nice comedic interlude for what is essentially a very serious game. You know, you get to kind of see how the party as a camp, because they talk about this sometimes in the game. They're literally essentially a caravan as they move between battles.
Yeah, there's a Battlestar Galactica kind of edge to it, where they're sort of being decimated. There's very few of them left, and now they're facing this giant empire that's chasing them down, and they have to somehow survive and scrap out a living here. And they sort of hope to overthrow the empire, but it would almost be enough if they could just get away and live to see another day.
And sometimes you kind of get to see, and since, I mean, the majority of the game takes place either right before, during, or right after these battles, or sometimes when you have this sort of limited omniscient third person where you kind of get to see to an extent events going on outside of the influence of the caravan.
Right. So which is kind of interesting, as you see the bad guys start to kill each other off, because there's one character who is very obviously the most evil character in the game. And he sort of his character portrait leans over in a menacing way. He literally cackles. And it's quite clear that he is actually conspiring against his own fellow evil generals to become more evil than even they. And when you meet a character in the enemy army who actually seems to have some sense of humanity, that's a sure sign that person's about to be killed off by this super evil vampire general or whatever he is.
Yeah. But what I was referencing more is sort of seeing the interactions of the party members. So you kind of get an idea of what's happening outside of this immediacy around the battles. Like, what the day-to-day is in this caravan when they're not constantly trying to not die.
It's actually kind of a common theme in Japanese RPGs for these minor character interactions to be very rich and fulfilling, and for people to latch onto them. If you look at like the Tales franchise, like Tales of Symphonia, Tales of Phantasia, those games are famous for what's called party talk, which is this completely optional dialogue that you can just sort of activate any time outside of a battle, and the characters who are in your party will just shoot the shit. You know, they just talk about whatever, and they're often very comical, and they maybe reveal aspects of their character that you otherwise wouldn't get. It's totally optional, and it's dialogue that you would never get in the course of the main plot events, because those tend to be more serious occurrences, you know. So it is a kind of an interesting, like you said, campfire talk, where, like, this is the kind of stuff that the characters talk about when they're not in the middle of a battle. But in Fire Emblem, in this game, I didn't really get any of that. Where are you getting this stuff, James?
They're all dead. That's it.
Yeah, maybe it's just that all my characters are dead, and the ones who are left are so haggard that they can't be bothered.
It's like, yeah, I really, really miss Franz, guys. Yeah, I know. It's really sad. No, but I mean, so you do have to use the support mechanic in some cases to get to see it, because you have to develop the relationship between those characters in order for them to actually have these sorts of weird little interactions between each other.
So then would you go to the support menu to view this conversation that you're talking about?
No, you go the support menu tells you who has a support relationship with other characters. So then you know in battle, okay, if I put them next to each other, I'll get that advantage. And then occasionally in battle, when you put a character who has a support relationship with another one next to each other, one of your options is actually support. At which point they'll have this weird conversation about the battle with each other in this very brief second. Well, one will say, sometimes they give you hints about the battle too. They might say something that's going on, or they might just say, it may be something as simple as one telling the other one just to keep going. I know this is a tough situation. Just keep at it. We're almost there. And that gives some kind of stat boost to the characters for the remainder of the battle.
So why don't we shift gears here and talk about difficulty, because this was a very popular topic of discussion.
It's hard!
And I'm curious to hear what we all thought about the difficulty of the game, but let's start off with a couple of forum posts. Fiendlord Timme posted, I played Sacred Stones about a year ago. Having played the original Fire Emblem for GBA, Shadow Dragon, Radiant Dawn, and about half of Path of Radiance, I have to say this one was the most forgettable. I'm struggling to remember anything about it. It may have something to do with this being the easiest, in my opinion, Fire Emblem game. Some of the stages in the other games are burned into my mind because of the horror I went through to beat them. The difficulty in Sacred Stones is more of a mild annoyance. And NoName2200 basically agreed, said Fire Emblem 7, the one before this, struck me as being extremely old school in its design and philosophy. It seemed generally more difficult, money was tighter, promotions were tougher to get, and grinding was nearly impossible since there weren't many ways to beef up your characters. Oh, and make sure you buy everything you need from the stores because there ain't no going back afterwards.
No, there isn't.
By contrast, Sacred Stone seems like Nintendo is trying to modernize the series. Being able to revisit shops is hugely beneficial. Grinding is not only easy, but the creation of two separate areas devoted to that makes me think the developers are encouraging it.
Yeah, I don't know whether they're so much encouraging it, but I feel like it's a safety net, as I said before.
Sure.
I don't care about weak characters. There's a safety net for them.
I think the fact that you've got that ability, it probably just assuages people. You know, it, for me even, I kind of thought, well, if it comes to it, I could do that, but I really didn't want to because I wanted to make as much progress
and
as I could.
And you didn't need to.
And in the end, I didn't have to. So that's good. So, but there is something that I've sort of heard a little bit. It didn't factor into my decision when I made it, but as I said before, there's that fork in the road where you choose either the brother or the sister.
Yeah.
And I went with the sister, and apparently those missions that you get with her are somewhat easier, people seem to think.
Oh, really?
See, I've never gone with the sister, so I always assumed it was equal, but I could see there are some levels with the brother missions that seem unfair.
I went with Erica because I felt like it was interesting that in a video game period that the main character could be female.
And not the ridiculous over-sexualized female.
Oh, no,
not at all. She's a smart, capable individual.
Oh, she does something really fucking dumb.
She does. I know she does. I've heard. But
that's sad.
But I mean, she's not dumb in the traditional sense. She's not vanilla. I mean, you could deal with her. She's normal.
James, do you know, do the storylines merge towards the end? Or
yeah.
Yeah.
It's pretty much like three acts to it. There's before the split, right. The second act is the split, and then the third act is you're back together again.
The reuniting,
okay.
Yeah. And in fact, other Fire Emblem games have followed that general philosophy as well, where at the end, everybody comes back together, and it's time to go beat the crap out of somebody.
Sure. I mean, at the point is, for me, I don't know, perhaps if I played the Brother's Route, I might have felt more in need of going to give myself a leg up with a bit of grinding here or there or whatever. So, yeah. But I mean, that may also factor into perhaps why some people might think that this is quite like remarkably easier than some other Fire Emblem games if you just played what may be the somewhat easier route. But it's clear, as I said, just from when I was reading reviews back when the game came out originally, it was clear to the reviewers then that some of these things were put in there probably to be a bit more welcoming than the original GBA game, which got a lot of plaudits, but ultimately, you know, some of the things surrounding it, some of the comments about the sort of punitive elements of the game did put me off. I mean, it's just a fact, and I didn't actually buy this game, but I did consider buying it more because I knew it had some of these kind of safety net measures in effect.
I think the word of mouth actually probably scared Nintendo more after the first game, because the word of mouth after people who played this game, and I'm certainly guilty of it as anybody else, was, holy crap! Because there really wasn't. I mean, people didn't have expectations coming in this game. I mean, I did because I played.
Well, but I think the real problem is that people's expectations from playing other, you know, somewhat similar games are very much to the contrary. I mean, that that's the thing, is that I don't really see there being something wrong with this idea at all. I think it's kind of a cool idea. It gives you another sort of level of agency as the player in terms of, you know, when is it an acceptable loss and all that kind of thing. I mean, it injects some interesting dilemmas and, you know, can affect the way you play, all this kind of stuff. I think it's all perfectly valid, but there's just a feeling that people bring with them when they've been playing other games where death is not permanent, that it's just unfair. I think it's just an emotional response that you have because
sure.
You've been conditioned by other things. So, whereas with Fire Emblem in Japan, the Game Boy one was Fire Emblem 7. They've been conditioned.
It's a pretty known quantity.
Right. And in fact, the closest comparison I can find here is in the Ogre Battle games, where you can lose someone if at the end of the battle you haven't revived them.
Yeah.
And in Final Fantasy Tactics, you have 3 turns to bring someone back if they die. And if you don't do it quickly enough, they will die forever. But you certainly almost always have an opportunity. You might struggle, and it might put you in harm's way to go and try to get that person back. But you do have the option. This is a perfect segue into a forum post from Synaptic, who said, "It's just too unforgiving. A game can be challenging without being soul-crushingly cruel. I love my 3DS, but I don't feel like throwing it out the window. The sad thing is, this game is so close to being great. What would make it better? Number one, the ability to create more than 3 saves and do so at any time during a battle. Number two, the ability to revive lost characters. You don't have to make it cheap, just possible. Number three, more opportunities for more interesting grinding." And it's really interesting. If you look back at the couple posts previous to that that we had read out, a lot of people were saying this game's almost too easy, or at the very least, it is much easier than other games in the series.
As someone who has played the Super Nintendo game, which is soul-crushing,
mm-hmm.
and Shadow Dragon on DS is supposed to be that kind of hard.
Well, it's all relative, because a lot of Fire Emblem fans think Sacred Stone is the easiest one, and that if you're coming into this...
Oh no, Path of Rage is the easiest one.
Well, if you're coming into this game without having played other strategy RPGs, like I would assume Synaptic, just the way that it's set up, the way that it doesn't tell you... I mean, obviously, this is a very deep, very complex game, and there's a lot of systems going on here that may not be very evident the first time you play through the game, unless you have someone sort of guiding you along. So it can very much feel like I really feel out of my depth here. Like, I know there are better ways to do this, but I don't know what they are, and I'm trying to do what seems natural and intuitive, and I'm being punished for it. And that seems to be what Synaptic got out of it, and he's sort of saying the things that this game does, he wants it to do even more of that. Like, this game has grinding, but not enough.
Yeah, well, that's the interesting point, though, isn't it? I mean, I would say in some ways I'm not necessarily a huge Fire Emblem fan, just having played this one game so far, and I'm not necessarily a huge JRPG or strategy RPG fan in general. But I would find it to be kind of a shame, in a way, to take it more towards some of its contemporaries and lose that unique quality that it has. But the thing is, because it does that a bit, because it has some grinding options and whatnot, it does kind of open the door for that possibility, doesn't it? For people to then think, well, then why can't we take it a bit further? That's probably why some people prefer the relative purity of other installments.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Oboy posted a response to Synaptic and said, that would remove the whole point of the game. Fire Emblem is one of the few games that has actual long-term consequences, which you can choose to not accept by reloading an older save. By making you value your units and grow them, it makes you closer to them, at least in a gameplay sense. Whether you have an emotional attachment to them as characters is something different, as that depends on how much you care about their story.
I would agree.
There are other games where characters die, like in Final Fantasy Tactics, but you can always grind out a new one from a recruit, making them feel no different to a unit in Advance Wars. I think it's a very salient point. Now, whether you appreciate that or not is really a personal matter, but I think there's no doubt that this aspect really does give Fire Emblem its identity as a series, and it's what people always remember about it. And if you love Fire Emblem, this is probably one of the things you love about it, because if you didn't, you'd play a different strategy game.
I would argue most people who play this series love that, but they kind of love to hate it. Like, they accept it. It's part of the mythos, but it does frustrate them.
Well, it brings in a big element of tension into the gameplay, which is, you know, a bit different from other strategy games you might have played, whether they be sort of the RPG kind or an Advance Wars. And it's kind of played up on a couple of mission templates where the goal is simply to survive a certain number of turns. And of course, now the main thing is you've got to keep your primary character alive for that number of turns and you succeed. But if you're trying to keep your key units alive, as many units as you possibly can, and everyone obviously being the best case scenario, that's very tense, you know, because it's the horizon is there. You know, you only have to last another 3 turns, and sometimes it could come down to, well, you know, if I just don't get a bit of bad luck with a critical hit or whatever, you know, I'm going to be okay.
And then it comes.
Seeing that out, you know, it is tense in a way that I can't say as I've really seen that in a comparable game.
There is a singular comparable mission in any JRPG strategy game I've ever played, and I can't remember if anybody here made it, but there's an Ogre Battle 64 mission in which you start with essentially two villages, and immediately you're thrown into another battle where they say, we're about to get swamped. And you have like 7 or 8 turns of just the most unrelenting combat in that game that you will ever see. And it's harrowing, it's stressful, and literally there is a ring of solid enemies around you. You just have to just go, oh God, how long can I hold them back?
I can see the excitement in that.
But this is that in the extreme, because once you break that offensive in those missions, you can then go about fixing whatever damage was done. In this game, that's it. Anybody who dies is out. I mean, that's the end of it. So it's even more tense if you're trying to keep them alive, because you have to constantly manage this sort of defensive rotation where you're putting people on the front and pulling people back to get them sort of rejuvenated for the next round. And this is actually when somebody mentioned the ability to go back to the stores being a huge addition, because weapons run out in this game. And we haven't talked about that. Weapons have a set number of uses.
I find that to be pretty irritating, and I don't really feel that it adds much to the game. It's really just a chore that you have to make sure you have a couple extras and that you can get them to the front lines, but I really don't feel that it adds much strategy. I've never made a decision on where to go or what to attack based on that.
Well, one of the things is you can find, you know, rare weapons, special, yes, not just the stock, you know, iron lance or whatever from the armory in the menu, or even some of the more predictable things from the shops, but something special, like an enemy might drop it or something like that. And then, of course, that's limited use, you know, and you know you're not just going to be able to buy another one.
I would understand if those were limited use, but does a steel lance really need to be limited use? I can go buy another one for a pittance.
So, to me, what that does is, I do make tactical decisions based on these weapons. I'll look at what weapons I can afford and what weapons have usability. I'll have to say, well, this weapon's cheaper, but looking at the numbers, I'm still going to kill this guy either way with the crappier weapon. So I might as well use that one for this one and save this weapon for more exclusive tasks. But what it also requires me to do is keep track of these numbers in my head of, okay, this guy needs his equipment changed out this mission, because if I go into the next mission, that thing's going to get worn out.
Yeah, you got to prepare before the mission as well, haven't you?
Do I have enough money to re-equip everybody? Well, not really. So whose weapons are in need of replacement but can probably make it the next battle? There's just this sort of shifting that I have to constantly do that I don't see in other games, because there's not as many systems of play in other games.
And you love that shit, James.
Well, yeah, I'm a computer scientist. This game is made for computer scientists, effectively.
I think you love it more than the average player, but fair enough. So we've got to wind down our conversation here, so I wanted to just get our final thoughts from each one about your experience and, you know, what you kind of took away from it. And I think I'll start off by just saying that I wasn't thrilled about playing this game just because of the time commitment and the fact that I've played other strategy RPGs, so I didn't expect this to really be a revelation, and it wasn't, but I am glad that I finally have been exposed to the series, and I think, you know, I would be interested in playing another Fire Emblem game in the future, maybe the GameCube one,
yes,
although it's pretty old by now, but it's very pretty. The presentation is a huge step up from this GBA game, and, you know, from what very little I played of it, I thought it was pretty attractive and pretty cool. So TYP gave it a very high recommendation. So at some point, you know, it's kind of hard for me to motivate myself to go seek out a GameCube game and play it, especially a
There is a 3DS one coming up too, so.
Yeah, maybe the 3DS one is a better choice for me, depending on.
Well, for me, I'd always say portability in this kind of game is a big deal.
It is. It is a big deal for this. Yeah.
Having played Ogre Battle for Retroactive, having played Shiny Force for Retroactive, and they were both obviously on the virtual consoles, it was tied to the TV. It was so much easier to get through this by virtue of the fact that it was a portable game, and obviously the conveniences we talked about with the saving and everything. I really like that aspect of it. So I really enjoyed this. I mean, not surprisingly, I really like Advance Wars. everyone's always sort of talked about the similarities and stuff, and ultimately I haven't really run afoul of some of the more harsh aspects of the series that people talk about. So.
Well, yeah, and that's what I wanted to get into with my sort of closing thoughts is that, you know, I sort of went into this very gung-ho and sort of I steeled myself to play Fire Emblem because that's what the people voted for. So I sort of went into it with this slash-and-burn mentality. You know, I sort of teased people in the thread that I was just going to let every soldier die on the battlefield and every soldier left behind or whatever. And it was just going to, I was just going to plow through it and just try to get through as much of it as possible and not worry about playing it properly. And everyone in the forum thread and James warned me that this would totally screw me over and that I would have not a good experience or that I would lose too many characters and I would reach a point where I just could not even continue forward at all, or that the game would become oppressively difficult because of this approach I was taking. And in the end, none of that turned out to be true.
Now, let's be clear. That is definitely dependent on who you lose.
Sure. And maybe I got lucky, because I did lose several characters.
And you're also only up to 12, so...
Yeah, right. I understand. I haven't beaten the game. And I do have some experience with these games, so maybe just innately, I did not play stupidly. Maybe I didn't play brilliantly, but I avoided certain pitfalls. But I think playing fairly aggressively and committing to your decisions and not going back and restarting over and over again to try to get the perfect run through has worked out surprisingly well for me. And because of that, I did enjoy the game more than I expected to. I was kind of surprised, very pleasantly surprised, that I was able to play the game in the way I wanted to play the game and wasn't, that it doesn't seem like I've really been punished for it. And so that has been nice for me, and it gives me hope that I could enjoy another Fire Emblem game playing through it this same way, especially if I stay away from the ones that are clearly known to be excruciatingly difficult.
Fuck you, Shadow Dragon.
So I will avoid those. That doesn't appeal to me at all. But if there's another game that's sort of on a similar level as Sacred Stone in terms of difficulty, I'd be willing to play that again because now I know that I can do it in a relatively stressless manner. I don't have to worry. I don't have to nitpick over what happens quite so much. And I can still make it through and still have a good experience. So that's kind of what I'm taking away from it. I'm pretty happy overall with how things went down. So, Greg, what about you? What's your kind of overall takeaway from it?
Yeah, well, I enjoyed it quite a lot, actually. And so, I mean, I'd be in the market for more Fire Emblem in the future now. I think this was a good entry point. As I said, I'll probably stick to portable entries in the future. But
sure.
The biggest sort of complementary characteristic it has to Advance Wars is just that the way that your units develop across all the missions, you know, so that you will find that your ways of playing and all that will sort of develop in a kind of linear and organic way. Whereas in Advance Wars, you know, each particular mission could be completely different.
It's more scenario based in Advance Wars. It's like you kind of have to use whatever they give you.
Yeah, with this, you've still got a scenario kind of feel, as I outlined, some of these different ones you get, you know, the odd fog of war mission, the odd mission with dangerous terrain, or there's ones where the enemies can actually sort of make bridges by destroying trees and things like that. You know, there's a lot of ones that have some sort of unique wrinkle to make them different. But at the same time, there's that continuity of you're developing characters and you're developing strategies around those characters that are constantly evolving. Mm-hmm. You know, so you kind of grow yourself as the player, just your understanding of the way the systems work in this game, along with actually what your characters are capable of. And that is very satisfying.
So, like, by the time you and I get to the end of the game, we might have completely different ways of finishing the final couple of missions because even though we started with the same resources over the long course of the game, we developed those resources in different ways. In some cases, we lost different units that no longer factor into our strategies. And so by the end of the game, we're actually playing it in two very different ways. I think that's pretty exciting. I think that's pretty cool. And as long as it's possible to have multiple valid ways of doing it. And I think it's pretty clear that there are multiple valid ways of doing it. And James, I'm going to switch up the question a little bit for you since you have so much experience with the franchise already. But this is your second time playing the Sacred Stones, and I wanted to see if your opinion of the game had changed going back to it now for Retroactive or discussing it, or if just playing through it again made you realize something about the game or the series that you maybe hadn't before.
So what I found somewhat weird about the whole choice of this game as being the one that they put on the Virtual Console rather than its predecessor was it always seemed to me that you'd want to put the first one out there first. In my mind, I had sort of blurred the distinction between the two because I had played them about a decade ago. So it's been a while. And what I concluded was that they made the right call putting this one on instead of Fire Emblem, because like the people in the talkback said, Fire Emblem
FE7, as the kids call it,
is considerably less approachable. Even things like the shot we talked about are so much more obtuse and require so much more foreknowledge, and there's so much less opportunity to recover from your own boneheadedness. This is probably the right game for them to put out there to introduce the 3DS game. And I mean, I don't think for a second that wasn't a deliberate move on their part, saying, aha, we have a 3DS game coming out, we should put a free GBA game out there, considering this series isn't our most exposed, and it's been a while.
Yeah, and there's been now having, you know, this came at the start of a sort of wave of Fire Emblem games that got localized. You had the original GBA one, then this, then GameCube, then Wii, Shadow Dragon, but they've actually sort of gone back now because there was a DS game that didn't get localized, so
yes.
It slipped back into obscurity a little bit after a sort of F-Zero like prolific phase in
yes.
the middle part of the last decade. So maybe they are kind of preparing for a bit of a relaunch of it in the Western markets.
For me, this is a good starting point for somebody who doesn't know the series, because it does do things its own way. To an extent, it's as difficult as you want to make it, although discernibly, some elements of the game can prove to be quite challenging. It's not nearly what I remember its predecessor being, which is just masochism and hate.
All right, well, on the notes of masochism and hate, we're going to wrap up this Retroactive.
Just like every other week.
And we're going to wrap up this episode. Before we go, wanted to mention that we will try to get back to listener mail next week. We've already got a few in the can that are probably going to be on the show. They're really good. But, of course, you can get your email read on the show as well. Just send it to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. We do love to hear from our fans. Let us know what you thought of the episode and the Retroactive. And, of course, you'll want to be sure to participate next time. We'll have a new Retroactive coming up eventually. So, yeah, I wanted to plug a couple of things going on. Last week we had a lot of plugs for Nintendo World Report podcasts, of which there were four released last week, I think. But this week I did want to mention a few things going on over at Crosstalk. It's a friends of the show and former host Carl Castaneda. That's his website. And I'm on a couple shows over there I wanted to tell you about. We just did recorded a Box Office Poison, which is our movie podcast, where we did our top five lists of 2011. And that is a really fun show. There you learn a lot about movies that you should check out. Some of them you've heard of, some of them maybe not. But that was a really fun one to do. And I've had a couple of my other podcasts, Discover Music Project, that I host and produce and edit. Had one with Carl on where we talked about the Velvet Underground, and that is really interesting, very influential band on numerous kinds of music that followed. And then the next episode, which will be out very soon, is with John Rend, a friend of mine, and we talk about A Tribe Called Quest. So finally, since John has been stalling on his hip-hop episode for a very long time... I went to other sources, and I got my fix with Tribe Called Quest, which is a really, really cool hip-hop band. Very, very interesting stuff. And you can download all those shows over at iTunes, and while you're there, you can leave a review for Radio Free Nintendo. We'd really appreciate it. It does help people find the show. It increases our EPIN. So I hope that you'll do that. Give us a five-star review and write something nice on there. Many of you have already done this, and I thank you very much. But if you haven't, it only takes a minute, girl, to fall in love and write a review of this podcast on iTunes. You can all... I'm killing these guys, by the way. And finally, you can like us on Facebook. So there's two separate pages. You can like Radio Free Nintendo on Facebook. You should definitely do that, and then you'll be kept abreast of updates throughout the week. You'll find out as soon as the new episodes are posted, etc. And that's a good thing to do. But then you can also like Nintendo World Report on Facebook, and we're getting very close. As of this recording, we're on the precipice of 1,000 fans for Nintendo World Report on Facebook.
Which is 20,000 too few.
Yeah, but it's a good milestone, and Neil has promised that if we reach 1,000, he will start to award random prizes from our prize vault to people who are fans of the site.
That might be a threat.
So there's no telling what you might get, but if you go and like the website, you might just win a prize. So if that's not incentive, I don't know what is. So be sure and head over to do that as well. And that is the end of the show. Thanks for listening through all of this. I hope you enjoyed it. I sure hope you like Fire Emblem after all that. And we will talk to you next week here on Radio Free Nintendo. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let me try that again.
I want to do it.
Go ahead.
Fire Emblem. This is Fire Emblem. Welcome to the Fire Emblem conversation. We're going to get some fire in your emblems. Let's get this. Here we go. That's your intro. Let's go.
No.
Yeah, that's okay. Here we are.
I'm not coming back from the break. Just fire.